started. Okay. This is Jim Boning of the Center for History of Chemistry. Today is June 17th, 1987. I'm speaking with Professor Richard Stein at the Graduate Research Center at the University of Massachusetts. Professor Stein, you were born on the 21st of August, 1925 in New York City. Could you tell me something about your parents, their names and occupation?
Oh, my father was Isidore Stein. He is deceased now, but he was born also in New York City, in Brooklyn, I think. And he was in the women's clothing business. My mother was Florence Lungood, also deceased. She was also born in New York City.
And where did you grow up in New York?
In the town of Far Rockaway, which is in the southeast corner of New York City, just bordering on Nassau County.
Yes.
It's a kind of interesting town. It turns out to be the same town that Richard Feynman, the Nobel Prize winner in physics, grew up with. And I got my inspiration in science in elementary school there, and I had just visited 2 days ago on Long Island, my former science teacher, who probably is distinguished by being one of the few science teachers that have had 2 Nobel Prize winners as students. The other Nobel Prize winner that was from there is Berit Blumberg, who got the Nobel Prize in medicine. And Berit and I used to be chums in elementary school, and we once had a project of trying to make gold from seawater, and we spent most of the summer lugging jars of seawater to our home laboratory from the ocean.
That's interesting. I'd like to go back and ask you a little bit about your early education, and where did you first go to elementary school, or your elementary education, and was it in Far Rockaway?
Yeah, it was in Public School 39 in Far Rockaway, Queens. And then I went to high school at Brooklyn Technical High School. This elementary school teacher, Arthur Charlton, recommended I go there. At the time, it was a quality high school in New York. That and the Bronx High School of Science were the 2 places to go for people who were interested in science and engineering. So it meant traveling back and forth about 25 miles each day to go there, but it was well worth doing.
I'd like to explore a little more this early interest in science. When did that start? Now, did that start at the elementary level?
Yeah.
Could you tell me more about that?
Well, it probably started when I was in about 6th or 7th grade. This teacher, Arthur Charlton, had a science club, and I think this was a very effective device. It was back in the days when, well, he had mentioned at the time that then the salaries of teachers were competitive with the salaries of doctors and lawyers, and they went into a desirable economic state, and teachers really devoted much more time to teaching, and they were quality people than they do today. And the science club was something that would meet after school, and every week the idea would be that the various members of the club would devise experiments that they would do for the club, and then the club would vote on who did the best experiment that week, and there would be kind of a competition, and it would very inspirational.
How many people were involved in that club?
Oh, there were probably about 10, and I think that probably at least half of the people have gone on to become university professors.
That's interesting. What kind of science did you range? Chemistry, biology, physics? Did it range all over?
Oh, the things I did were mostly chemistry oriented, but there was a kind of chemistry that sort of appeals to people at that age, explosions and smells and smokes and that sort of thing.
Had you had any exposure to chemistry prior to that? Or was that science club and this teacher their first exposure?
That was one of the first. Well, about that period of time, a little bit after that, I guess in 1939, there was a New York World's Fair, and I guess I was in high school at that time, and that was a big inspiration to me. I had a student ticket for going to Brooklyn, so this ticket also enabled me to go into Flushing to the World's Fair weekends, and I could get an annual pass fairly cheaply that enabled me to go essentially an unlimited number of times. So I spent most of my weekends that year there, and It was my first taste of seeing things like television and automatic dishwashers and artificial lightning and DuPont's exhibit and better things of better living and so on. So that made a very great impression on me.
Okay, you were four, that was 30, what, 39?
39,
so you
yeah.
Were four, you were 14.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember any of the other people involved in the science club?
Yeah, in fact, I've kept up contact with a few of them. One of them, for example, was a professor at Rutgers University, Lionel Goodman, who's in the chemistry department and done some very fine work in molecular spectroscopy. Another person is a physicist, Gerard Salzman, who was actually teaching physics at the Boston campus of University of Mass. He's interested in relativity theory and things of that sort.
It's interesting because you went in somewhat different ways.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't all become chemists per se.
Yeah.
But and how long were you involved in that science club then?
Oh, it was about my last 2 or 3 years of elementary school.
Okay. And when did this project occur with gold from seawater?
That was probably toward the end of that period.
What were you doing in trying to carry out that?
Well, then the first project was evaporating the water down to concentrate the salts, but then we tried to make separations using essentially qualitative analysis type procedures of precipitating out various things in order to concentrate the gold. I think we actually got a little bit of it, but it was probably the most expensive gold that was ever prepared.
And where did you get the water from?
Right the ocean.
Right,
yeah.
Right off the
Rockaways, right, yeah. By the ocean. So we just go down on our bicycles and lug back gallon jugs of water. This was before one had polyethylene jugs, so I had to be glass, which we dropped a few of them, I think.
What was it like growing up at that time in Far Rockaway with your family situation?
Well, it was a very nice place to grow up because then it was a much, much more high-class community than it is now. And sort of the upper, it was populated mostly by upper middle class people, most of whom worked in New York, in Manhattan, and commuted. But one could spend summers by the seashore and fishing and boating, and it was relatively rural for being in New York City.
Yeah. What about the Depression? Did the Depression have any effect on
it? It certainly did. My father had worked his way up in business from being essentially the office boy at his company, the president of the company. And the company made real silk undergarments, and these obviously didn't sell very well during the Depression, so the company folded, and he had to go back, and, well, he was unemployed for a few years, and then he essentially did door-to-door sales, and for a person of his age, this was a great job, but he took it very well, and he worked his way back to starting up a new company and working his way up to an executive position again. But I think this was fairly hard on his health, and I suspect it led to the disease, which he finally died of. But what it meant is that going to college and so on was quite uncertain for me. When I went to Brooklyn Tech, one had the option of taking a college preparatory course, which I didn't do. I took a so-called chemistry course, which was job-oriented. It was mostly for people who would go to work right after school, which I thought I would have to do. But then the family pulled together its resources, and my sister decided not to go to college, and she worked, and I was able to go to Brooklyn Valley then, and I think that was sort of very fortunate. But I did think very carefully about whether I would go to college and actually interviewed for some jobs at that time.
Let me follow up on the jobs. What kind of, well, I'd like to back up and talk about Brooklyn Tech for a while, if I
mm-hmm.
could. First of all, how many of the people in your group from your elementary school, that science club, did many others go on to Brooklyn Tech?
No, not too many. There are only about 2 or 3 that did, yeah.
And could you tell me something about the school? What was it like?
Well, it was very competitive. One had to take an entrance exam to go in. In fact, we were just talking to my ag science teacher about this last week, because I was rather small and puny, and I was young for the age of my graduating class. I had skipped a few grades in school, and I was fairly protected by my mother particularly, so that I had never really traveled by myself very much. But this teacher felt very strongly that I should go there, and my mother felt very conservative about doing this. So he actually assigned a big, burly Italian person to essentially act as my bodyguard to go along to take the entrance exam, because here I had to venture into downtown Brooklyn, which I had never done by myself. And I think it was a set of care that this guy took that made a big difference to me. And, you know, at first traveling to Brooklyn, the city school, was a relatively traumatic experience to me, but I think it was good for me, because I had to do a lot of growing up, and I cut the apron strings from home a little bit, and it made me very resourceful.
How old were you when you started there? You said you skipped several grades.
Yeah, I was, I guess normally one is, when one graduates from eighth grade, one is normally about 14. I think I was 12.
You said you took the chemistry course. What kind of choices did you have when you started?
Well, there were a number of options. One of these was chemistry. One was electrical, another mechanical engineering, another civil engineering. They were all technically oriented courses, engineering sort of courses. In fact, the chemistry course was a fairly strongly engineering-oriented chemistry course. But maybe it was good that I did this rather than take the college course, because it meant that I got very good technical training and learned some engineering disciplines like drafting and machine shop work and foundry work and so on. And I got a feeling for how industry worked. And this has been very good for my background. I think today when I go into a factory, I have a good understanding of what happens. And several years ago, I was a member of the first delegation of chemists and chemical engineers to go to the People's Republic of China, and we visited all sorts of plants that in all disciplines of chemistry, and I felt pretty much at home. And in fact, China a couple of years ago was back where the U.S. was about at the time I went to high school, so that I felt very, very familiar with many of the things I saw. In fact, it was a revelation, because one doesn't see many of these things in this country anymore that one saw there.
Did you get practical experience in local industry in Brooklyn at the high
school? We went on plant tours, and you know, we went to drug factories. At that time, for example, Charles Pfizer was sort of a backyard operation in Brooklyn. It was a pretty small company. In fact, it was one where I took a job interview when I graduated from high school. And we visited there, for example, and they were just in the beginnings of manufacturing drugs.
Can you tell me something about two aspects? Let's start with your teachers. Do you remember any of your teachers who had any specific influence?
In high school?
Yes.
Yeah, one of them, very good chemistry teacher's name was Saul Dushman, and he was related to, he may have been his brother of a person also whose name was Dushman, who worked at General Electric Research Lab in Schenectady, and he was a leading worker in the field of high vacuum science, and he was an excellent chemistry teacher. Who else do I remember? I remember there was a person, sort of an English background person, his name was Charman, and he taught pattern making, how to make molds for casting metal, and he was a very good teacher. I think his name was Heapy, he taught a course called Industrial Processes, where we'd study, you know, how industrial processes worked. And there was another one whose name was Coyle, and he taught a a course called Power Laboratory, which was really a lot of fun because this was a laboratory that was filled with things like diesel engines and gasoline engines, and we would actually operate these and do scientific experiments on them. We'd measure their thermodynamic efficiency and weigh the fuel that went in and measure the power output. And I learned a lot of good practical science doing that sort of thing.
Where did they get their support for all of this?
New York City school system.
City school system provided this.
One thing that we did there, and you know, I think in thinking about it now, I think that this is, has a direct implication in what I'm doing right now. I'm producing a video course right now for teaching industry, and at the time at Brooklyn Technical High School, they had a radio station there that was the radio station for the New York City school system. It would broadcast programs that were produced at Brooklyn Tech, and these would be received at various schools. And as an alternative to taking an ordinary English course, we could take what was called radio English. And we worked in the radio station, and we wrote scripts and operated the station and did acting and so on. And I did this, and you know, I learned a lot about this kind of a teaching technique, which I think has paid off in my teaching.
That's interesting. Did these programs, were they technical in nature?
Yeah. So in English, for example, instead of writing a theme on some abstract subject, one would often learn how to write a technical report. Now, I think it's a pity that the quality of education at schools like those of New York City has declined, and those kinds of things aren't happening today, because I think they have a great influence in one's life. I just got a letter yesterday, actually, from a professor in Japan who is the president of a technical junior college in Japan, which sounds to me very much like this sort of a place. And I think probably the success of Japan today in producing outstanding engineers and technologists is based upon very fine education at this level. And I feel it's a pity that we're really not getting this. Students don't learn good science and math for the most part in elementary schools today.
Could you tell me more about the chemistry? What kind of chemistry did you do?
Well, very, very good chemistry, actually. The chemistry courses we got, I think, were at a level that were quite comparable with elementary college-level courses. We, for example, had a course in analytical chemistry where I think the qualitative analysis that we had to do was harder than the qualitative analysis I had to do at Brooklyn Polytech when I got there. And as a result, when I got to Brooklyn Poly, the first few years was pretty easy because it was mostly a repeat of stuff I'd learned in high school.
Hmm. What kind of lab facilities did they have?
Quite good. Good equipment that I think would rival what one would find in elementary laboratories at most universities.
Did you take chemistry throughout the 4 years?
Yeah, we had elementary chemistry the first year, and then analytical chemistry, and then of course in industrial chemistry, and we had chemical engineering oriented courses, so we did, yeah.
It sounds like an incredible amount of chemistry for a high school atmosphere, in addition to all of the other things that you described that you've been doing.
Well, I would say if I were working in a company today and went to hire someone, I think a person graduating from that chemistry curriculum would make a better employee than the graduate of many of the colleges that weren't outstanding ones today.
You said you had to take an entrance exam.
Yeah.
What kind of an exam? How was that exam oriented?
It was sort of like the College Board exams today at a lower level, but there was sort of a general exam, and then there was one that was specifically oriented to math and science.
I see.
So that one really had to exhibit skills in mathematics at the elementary school level, particularly at problem-solving sort of things, applications of mathematical concepts, and the understanding of scientific principles as applied to common things.
I guess that's another question. Then, what kind of math background did you get at your high school level?
Well, it was again, strongly engineering-oriented math. For example, we had to take a course that involved surveying, and this meant a real strong application of trigonometry. And at that time, it was before calculators were available, but I remember I was using five-place logarithms to do my calculations, and I had a Karfel and SL log log decitrig duplex slide rule that I still have in my desk drawer. I actually had won this in a math contest in high school, and I still got it. And now students come in and they see the slide rule and they ask, what's that?
I recently bought each of my sons one. Our bookstore had found an old box that they were selling for 50 cents each, so mm-hmm. I bought each of my sons one so they would know what it was like. Okay, you said that as you were finishing high school, you weren't sure that you were going to be able to go on to college. Mm-hmm. And that you actually interviewed, and you mentioned Charles Fizer as being one. Did you look at interview at any other places as you were finishing up high school?
Yeah, I've forgotten what some of the other companies were, but they were mostly companies in the New York City, metropolitan New Jersey area.
And then what was the turning point in your going to, and why, let's say, Brooklyn, well, I guess it's closer, I was thinking of City College or other places in New York as well. Why Brooklyn Poly when the tables turned that you could finally go?
Well, Brooklyn Poly was well, one of the reasons why I considered Brooklyn Poly is they had a very extensive evening school program. Okay. And many of the, I think that their evening school was better known and larger than their day school. And one advantage of going there is that it would have been possible to supplement okay. one's income by working during the day. I actually didn't do that. I think my family support was such I didn't need to. But I still would take a lot of my courses in the evenings, which set my days more free to do research types of things. And there were a lot of, it was actually during the war and as a result, the population in the day school was fairly low and many of the professors were involved in military projects, so that there was a lot of flexibility in the education, which I think was a big advantage. And one could work on project-oriented things and spent a lot of the time during the day doing that. For example, I worked on a project for the Army that involved developing polyvinyl chloride coated fabrics that were used for Army raincoats and gun covers for use in the Pacific landings. And one of the concerns was the degradation of these by sunlight. And actually, I remember taking some of these into the Macy's Bureau of Standards because they had a fadometer. It was a carbon arc device for testing exposure of things to strong sunlight. And I would take samples into there during the day and irradiate those to see how well they would stand up. But there were many projects of that sort going on. Well, one of my acquaintances there was Sam Krim, who is now a professor at University of Michigan, and he's been head of the biophysics department there. And actually, he is the professor who recommended to us Xiaoling Su, who is a professor here in spectroscopy, and he was Xiaoling Su's professor.
I see.
But I got to know Sam at Brooklyn, and we were quite strong buddies, and our careers paralleled each other quite a bit since then. But Sam was also working on a military project with Roland Ward, who was a professor of inorganic chemistry and the person that taught me freshman chemistry at Brooklyn Poly, and he subsequently had become a professor at University of Connecticut. But Sam was working on a project developing phosphors for the Navy, and these were used for signaling back and forth between ships during the war so that they wouldn't be intercepted by, the radio signals wouldn't be intercepted by submarines, and these would be phosphors that would glow and they would be hit by infrared radiation, so they would be able to convert infrared into visible. And project like the sniper scope, which enabled soldiers to see in the dark, would a result of that. But Sam was involved with Roland Ward in developing these phosphors for that purpose.
It wasn't clear, it's just a minor detail, what year you started at Brooklyn.
Let's see, I graduated from Brooklyn Technical High School in 42.
Okay.
And then I graduated from Brooklyn Poly in 45.
Okay.
So I managed to finish the 4 years of college in about 2 3/4 years. The reason for that was that in the day school, most of the students were in the Army Specialized Training Program, the ASTP program, and civilian students just sort of got tagged on to this program and took the same quest curriculum, and of course the soldiers didn't get the summer vacations off, so we just went round the clock and our training, and as a result we got it all done in fairly short time. But the program was sort of unconventional. I remember I was taking Physics 1 and Physics 2 simultaneously, and I complained to the registrar that Physics 2 was a prerequisite for Physics 1, and he looked at my program and he said, well, you're taking Physics 1 in the morning and Physics 2 in the afternoon, so that's okay. But that was sort of typical of the types of things that went on. could you excuse me for just a moment?
Yeah.
Brooklyn Poly, proofread the manuscript of Turner's book on mechanical properties in polymers, which is a very significant book in polymer science.
Yes. Yes, I wanted to talk about Turner. But before I do, when you went to Poly, did you sign up as a chemistry major? I'm not clear what your choices were at that point.
No, actually, I started out in electrical engineering. And then I changed to chemical engineering, and then I changed to chemistry. I suspect if I had stayed around school long enough, I might have become a physicist. But I think that maybe that was good, too, because it meant that I got some training in a variety of fields. And I think really the name of the game today in science is interdisciplinary activities. And I think I got introduced to interdisciplinary thinking fairly early in my career.
What reasons were there for your making these changes?
Oh, I don't know. I think maybe my seeing artificial lightning and all of these things at New York World's Fair used to inspired me quite a bit. I was looking at my elementary school yearbook, and I noticed at that time I said my choice of a career was to be a television engineer. I think this might have been influenced by my fascination with television at the World's Fair. But that was before solid-state electronics got started, and I think I did very well in electrical engineering. I think I probably had best grades of anyone, but I think I got a little bit bored. I think it was mostly conventional electrical engineering at the time, and there wasn't too much exciting going on, and I found chemistry more innovative, more new things to do, but yet I had sort of the engineering background from Brooklyn Technical High School, so my entrance into chemistry was in chemical engineering.
I see.
But then, I think probably if U.S. had been on the metric system, I might still be a chemical engineer. But I got disgusted with pressures in pounds per square foot and BTUs and all this nonsense, and I thought that chemistry was much more logical with the metric system, and consequently I abandoned engineering.
Can you tell me something about the facilities at Brooklyn at the time?
At Brooklyn Poly?
Yes.
Well, it was back when they were on their Livingston Street campus, and the buildings were pretty ancient and falling apart. I know my research was done in what was called the South Building, and what was a converted morgue, and it still smelled of formaldehyde. And one of the discussions at the time, I remember, was whether the building held the electrical conduit up or the electrical conduit held the building up.
And what kind of chemistry, even as an electrical engineer, you were taking general chemistry, I would assume.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of, and that was a repeat, you said, of qualitative analysis and what you've done in high school. When did you start getting into some new chemistry?
Well, the general chemistry course was one that was given by Roland Ward, who is a very good teacher. And I think that livened up my interest. I took a physical chemistry course, and actually the physical chemistry was taught by an older professor by the name of Benjamin Caldwell, and it was a very conventional physical chemistry course. But I had some very good lab instructors. In fact, it turns out that one of my lab instructors in organic chemistry at Brooklyn Poly was Sidney Sidja, who since became an analytical chemistry professor here. And it was kind of interesting that I was on the committee which hired him as a professor, and he had been my instructor. But as I mentioned, the courses were very flexible, and in physical chemistry lab, we could essentially do research rather than doing experiments just from lab manuals. We could do research type of projects, and rather than do lots of little experiments, we did about two things during the semester that were sort of a mini research project. And
do you recall what you were doing?
Yep, I do, because it was kind of a marriage of my interest in chemistry and electricity, because I had done an electrochemistry type research project in which we were trying to develop electrodes for analysis, and we were looking at things like the silver electrode and so on for halogen analysis, and I made up solutions and mixtures of various halide ions and tried to see how well we could analyze these. It was kind of fun. And as a result of that, I almost became an electrochemist.
Well, I suppose that leads us to the next question, is when did you first become introduced to polymers?
Well, at one of the good things that I had at Brooklyn Poly was you were required to write a senior thesis. And I elected to do this under an analytical chemist, possibly as a result of this physical chemistry course. Gilbert Brown Lorenzo Smith. And one of Smith's interests was in use of electrochemistry for analysis. But I was just working for him for a short while when he became ill. And consequently, he gave up teaching for that year. And I had to find a new thesis advisor. And Raymond Kirk, who was head of the department, suggested that I might try working for Paul Doty, who had just come out of graduate school at Columbia, along with Bruno Zinn. And I suspect I was one of the first students that worked with Paul. And Paul had gotten his PhD at Columbia. And Bruno had also, and they had worked with guys like Joe Mayer and Victor Lemaire at Columbia. And it was just in the early days of doing good physical chemistry and polymers, measuring molecular weights and things of that sort. Paul Fleury had just published his work on thermodynamics of polymer solutions. And one of the things I used to have at Brooklyn at that time is Saturday morning seminars, and a speaker just about that time was Peter DeVay, who gave a seminar on his new light scattering method for measuring molecular weights. And he had developed this as a result of the rubber reserve program during the war, and in making synthetic rubber there was a need for new methods of measuring molecular weights of polymers. And DeVay had recalled Einstein's work on fluctuation theory as applied to light scattering, and applied this to studying polymers in solution. And we heard this seminar, and this encounter with Doty and Zim came shortly after that. And they suggested that perhaps I could try to use this method for my senior thesis, which I did, and was one of the first experimental papers using that technique and studying materials.
That was the cellulose acetate.
That paper, which was published in the Journal of American Chemical Society, was the cellulose acetate work. And about the same time, I had a paper on the classical theory of light scattering that was co-authored with Zimandoti that was published in volume one of the Polymer Bulletin, which was lasted for 1 year as the predecessor for the Journal of Polymer Science, which got started the year after that. But that essentially got written because in preparing the background chapter for my thesis, I had to find out what the theory was all about, and I worked pretty closely actually with Bruno Zim in trying to understand this, and that was a great experience for me because I had really knew nothing about statistical mechanics and so on when I started this, and it was a wonderful way to learn something about it. And writing that article was a very, very good educational experience for me. And, you know, I still look back at that article, and I think, you know, I'm very pleased with the result of that. Well, I remember when Debye was sort of very intuitive in the way he presented things, and he often gave results of his work without showing how they were derived. In fact, I remember after that having written to him to find out how he got some of his equations, and I don't think he remembered anymore, but referred me to one of his students to provide the details. But at the time Zimandoti and I wrote this article, we wanted to find out the derivation of the Debye equation for the scattering from a random polymer coil, which is still used today. I'm using it this very day for neutron scattering from polymer coils. But Debye gave that result, but never at that time had published the derivation of it. So I wanted to find out where it came from, and Bruno Zim and I re-derived it essentially, starting from scratch, and that was good training because I really learned how to do things that way.
And your math preparation, were you taking math courses as well as the early days of Brooklyn at Poly, so that your math background was at the right point for you to...
Yeah, and I feel that learning math and science together is a very valuable thing to do, and it made math much more realistic to me. I essentially wanted to learn math because I needed it. I mean, I had problems that I needed math for that I didn't know, and consequently I was driven to learn the math. And I remember I bought a book by Daniels, Mathematical Preparation for Physical Chemistry. And I bought this while I was in high school because I realized I needed calculus and I didn't know any calculus, and that was the first calculus I learned by myself from that book.
I have a copy of that book. Can you tell me more about Doty and Zim in terms of your work with them? You were an undergraduate. You were finishing up your senior thesis.
Well, they were young and enthusiastic, and they were involved in these military projects, too. And Brooklyn was really a very exciting place because, Tobolsky and Stockmeyer and people like that were coming in and out. And the really important people doing work in polymers in the world were going through there. And it was very crowded, and everyone was working evenings, and lab space was very tight, so you didn't get assigned a lab bench, but you got assigned a lab bench between such and such a time to work on. And it was good training for me to come to UMass, because UMass was in about that state when I first came, and many people when they came here at that time were aghast and more or less gave up, but for me I didn't feel very, very discouraged because I was used to working in that environment, and I knew when you could do work even though conditions weren't ideal.
And when did you meet Herman Mark?
Well, during the time I was undergraduate.
Can you tell me something about him at that time?
Well, he was sort of the father figure there, and I'd never really took a formal course with him, but I would hear him lecture and see him in action, and he was the reason why people would come. And well, I remember one of the things that happened while I was there is we had some Russians visit, and this was during the close to, if not during the period, well, it was just the beginnings of the period of McCarthyism, and there was a lot of anti-Russian feeling, and at that time, the Russians were very much restricted in traveling, and Americans were prohibited from visiting certain cities in Russia, and as a retaliation, the State Department prohibited the Russians from visiting places in the U.S., and one of the places they couldn't come to was Brooklyn, but they could come to Manhattan, so we kind of had discussions via the subway. We had to travel to Manhattan to see our Russian visitors.
That's interesting. Did Herman have any influence on you?
Oh, sure, yeah. I mean, he was sort of legendary. He was, you know, a fascinating guy, and, you know, much more worldly person than I had known, someone who did so many different things, and, you know, about this time there was this article about his life in the New Yorker.
Oh, yes. Did he come through the labs when you were working?
Yeah, he was extremely energetic and active, and he knew everyone.
What were your, well, the war was drawing to a close at the time that you finished. What were you looking at in terms of career choice?
Well, to come back to Herman Mark, I think, you know, one of the things that he did was to start the Polymer Research Institute at Brooklyn. And I remember in this New Yorker article, they said, well, how did you get the Polymer Research Institute started? And he said, well, the first thing I needed to do was to create a letterhead, and that was about all Brooklyn Valley could afford. Well, that was something I remembered when I came here, and I started a Polymer Institute here, and I think I followed his example. I created a letterhead, and we sort of pulled ourselves up by our own bootstraps, and observing him in action and how he did it at Brooklyn was a good lesson to me.
What were you thinking of as your work was ending at Brooklyn, in terms of beyond that point?
Well, Doty and Zim and Mark and so on, and Tobolsky will encourage me to go to graduate school, and I had considered Columbia as a place to go, and also Cornell, and I think I had fellowship offers from the two of those, and Tobolsky was from Princeton at the time, and I was traveled from Far Rockaway into Brooklyn through the 4 years of high school and 3 years of college, and I was sort of tired of the competitive, hectic life of New York City, and going to Princeton to look at it was very impressive as compared with the Brooklyn environment, and there seemed to be a little bit of heaven, and that I think sold me. I actually went to Brooklyn and elected to work with Henry Eyring at the time, and Eyring had been director of the Textile Institute and offered me a fellowship at the Textile Research Institute, which I accepted.
How did you make that contact with Eyring?
Through Arthur Tobolsky.
Okay. Yeah. Could you tell me something about that arrangement? There was a Textile Research Institute, there was a
Textile Foundation.
Foundation, there was a polymer.
Well, a textile foundation got started, I think, as a result of the U.S. taking over some of the patents from German companies during the war, and this went into a fund, and part of that fund set up the Textile Foundation. And one of the Textile Foundation's endeavors was to set up the Textile Research Institute Laboratory, which was an independent laboratory from Princeton. And they had a building which was in a former estate on Lake Carnegie, about a mile away from the campus. And they would offer fellowships to about five students a year who could pursue PhD studies at Princeton University, work with a Princeton professor, but work on a problem related to the Textile Institute's goal for their thesis, which is what I did.
And Eyring was associated?
Eyring was the director of the Textile Institute. In fact, when I came to Princeton, the Textile Institute was set up in Frick Laboratory. They didn't have the separate building. And during my first year, they moved out to their building in Lake Carnegie, and we were very intimately involved in that move because Henry Eyring was a very economical soul, and the way we moved is we rented a truck, and all of the graduate students physically moved all the laboratory equipment out of that building. And I remember the road was an old dirt road that was filled with ruts and puddles, and Iring was a Mormon and lived a very, very parsimonious life, and he had a coal furnace in his house. And every morning when he came into work, he would bring in a barrel of ashes from his furnace and stop on the way into work and dump the ashes in one of these mud holes. And I remember when I first arrived at Princeton, I fell into the clutches of George Halsey, who is now a professor at University of Washington, and he was also working with Iring. And George was a very peculiar sort of person. He got kicked out of Princeton for a while because George thought the only books in chemistry that were worth reading was the collected works of J. Willard Gibbs and Statistical Thermodynamics by Fowler and Guggenheim. And the organic chemists at Princeton, particularly Everett Wallace, were not too sympathetic with that view, and George didn't do very well on the organic qualifying exams, and as a result, he got thrown out of graduate school and then got brought back after he repented a bit. But George was very much of an individualist. He was sort of a child prodigy, and he took me over to Nassau Tavern for lunch every day, and I was pretty naive when I first came, and I thought this was typical behavior of a graduate student. I ought to learn differently. But Henry Iring would bring his peanut butter sandwich and apple into the laboratory to have his lunch, and George would ask Henry Iring to watch our apparatus while we went to Nassau Tavern to eat lunch. I, after a few weeks of this, I soon learned that this was not normal behavior.
How much of an interaction did you have with Iring then?
Quite a bit, actually. In fact, my first paper at Princeton was a joint paper with Iring and Halsey. And we tried to apply absolute reaction theory to the mechanical properties of textile fibers.
What kind of a person was he to work for?
Extremely informal, extremely enthusiastic, very inspirational. Iring came from a Western background. I guess he was born in Mexico, and he actually started out in mining engineering, and according to his story, at least, he changed to chemistry because he was afraid that rocks would fall on his head in a mine. I remember in his statistical thermodynamics course, he started out by showing how you would calculate the partition function of a horse. But that was kind of the approach he would take, and he was very enthusiastic about absolute reaction rate theory, and to the extent where he would try to explain how everything in the world worked on the basis of this, and what we would do, and before he would come in to teach a course, is the students would draw an activation energy diagram on the blackboard every day, and then Iring would just come in and fill in the details of a different problem. But I remember one of the things that he said during that period of time that had a great impression on me. He said, "You have a theory for everything. It's best to do an experiment. You should always do an experiment with a theory to guide you. And it's much better to do an experiment guided by a wrong theory than guided by none at all, because then the experiment does something for you. If the theory is wrong, the experiment proves it's wrong, and then you go on to correct the theory. Whereas if you don't have any theory, the experiment may not do anything." And there's a lot of truth to that, I think, and something I've repeated that story to students many times. I remember, my first paper at a scientific meeting was at a Chicago meeting. The second paper, I'll tell about the first in a moment, but the second paper at a scientific meeting was an American Chemical Society meeting in Chicago, and I went there by train from Princeton. I remember traveling there by overnight train with Henry Iring, and we shared a room. And spent most of the night with Iring trying to convert me to Mormonism.
I thought you were going to say you were talking about absolute reaction rate theory.
No, I remember going to another meeting with Bob Rundell, who I worked with after Irene left, who was a crystallographer, and I also shared a room with him and spent the night with him analyzing the space groups of the wallpaper. But maybe in those days when you had to share rooms with your professor, you had a good teaching experience, which many students miss today.
I forgot to follow up on Turner Alfred before. I was meant to do that. You said you proofread his.
Yeah, right.
Do you have any other interaction with Turner at Brooklyn?
Well, I mean, one would also discuss research with him. And, well, one of the interactions most people at Brooklyn had with Turner was drinking with him.
Yes.
He's a great beer guzzler.
Did he extend that to a wide circle of people? I mean, it was dynamic.
And Turner was an extremely informal guy. And, I remember we invited Turner. We invited Turner to Princeton to give a seminar, and after the seminar he disappeared, and we wondered what happened to him. Well, it turned out that he went to Trenton to drink beer with the stockroom keeper. So Turner wasn't too selective. He would be chummy with anyone. He was a very informal guy. A person who worked with Tobolsky, who was a graduate student about the time I was Bob Mesrobian, mm-hmm. who after this went on to Brooklyn Poly, so that sort of completes the cycle. But Turner subsequently became vice president of Continental Can. Yeah, it was Continental. And in the memorial book for Turner Alfrey that I guess Ray Boyer edited, there were many Turner Alfrey stories, and one of these was involved with the fact that he and Mesrobian had a bet. They used to play pinball together when they were at Brooklyn Poly, and they would bet beer, and Turner was much better at this than Mez, and I think at the end of their stay together at Brooklyn, Mez ended up owing Turner something like 2,000 cans of beer. Well, after this, when Mez became vice president of Continental Can was involved in considering canning beer, and they were testing canning beer, and they ended up with a large number of cans of bad beer, and Mez thought that this was a wonderful opportunity to pay back his bet, and he had a truck of 2,000 cans of bad beer that got placed on Turner's doorstep.
Was Turner's comment to that ever published?
Yeah, the story is in this book that Ray Boyer got together. To complete some of the stories about the Princeton experience, one of these involved interacting again with Sam Krim, who I mentioned before. And Sam came to Princeton, and he also worked with Arthur Tobolsky, and we overlapped for a year and published a paper together. And we built one of the first X-ray diffractometers together. And then I went on to Cambridge for postdoctoral work with Gordon Sutherland, and then Gordon Sutherland came back to Michigan, and Sam then worked for Gordon Sutherland too, and that was the way Sam became a professor at Michigan, from which
Cho Ling Su graduated and came here. And another connection is that George Halsey, as I mentioned, became a professor at University of Washington, and Frank Karras, who was in this department, got his PhD at University of Washington working with George Halsey. So there have been a lot of interconnections.
What was it like at Princeton at that time? You, let's say in terms of the courses you had to take, or the...
Well, Princeton was a very selective sort of place. They had a very fine group of students. One of the people who had graduated there was Bill, from that department, was Bill Baker, who subsequently became vice president of Bell Lab, in charge of Bell Labs, and a presidential science advisor. Let's see, Jack Hoffman, who became head of the Materials Institute of National Bureau of Standards, was a classmate at that time. Julian Gibbs was there, who became president of Amherst College. So there were many, many good associations that came from that period. But, well, one of the things that one had to do, and also I think inspired some thoughts that had its effect on my teaching, is there was the system of research proposals there at the time that was fairly unique. That is, in addition to passing qualifying examinations, a student had to propose some original research. At that time, you had to make 10 of these research proposals. Three-quarters of them had to be in fields different from your own. And these had to be 10 original ideas, and your final exam for your PhD was really not an exam on your thesis, but an exam on these research proposals, where the whole faculty would come, and these would all be specialists in all of these areas, so you really had a good going over. And actually, about half of these research proposals turned out to be subjects on which I subsequently did research and wrote papers, so that it was an extremely good training. Now, they subsequently decided that this was too tough a task for students, and I think they've cut it down to two or three proposals. But as a result of this, I recommended that this be a requirement here, which is now a requirement in both the chemistry and in the polymer science departments.
And how many do these people do?
Well, we originally had two in polymer science, but now we've cut it down to one.
Would you say that when you had to do 10, that they were compared to one? That's quite a change going from total of 10
yeah,
to one.
Yeah, it is. And getting those 10 together really was quite a hard task. And one of the advantages is you had to continually be alert for ideas for original research, and it changed one's point of view. Whenever you'd go to a seminar, you'd always be hungry for ideas for one of these proposals, and every time a new journal would come out, all of the students would rush to look at that journal to get some ideas, and it developed some good habits.
Do you think that only asking people to do one today is...
Well, you know, you always think that you had things tougher when you were younger, and we did. I'm not sure. I think we're being more lenient, and I'm not sure it's entirely good. But I think that, you know, in a sense, I think students are all leading a more easy life than we had to back then. I remember, for example, Hugh Taylor was head of the department then, and he was a tyrant in a way, and he had the rule that graduate students couldn't get married, and if they got married, he decided, well, they didn't need a fellowship. He took their fellowship away. After the students passed their exams, you'd make songs about the faculty members, and the one about Taylor was, "Here's to Taylor U.E. Stott, who says his grad should marry not, so they must lead a life of sin until they get their thesis in." But then when the GI Bill students came along, there was a changing last verse, which was, But now the Army foots the bill, so Huey lets them bring their Jill. But, you know, that was sort of typical. I remember George Halsey and I going to Henry Eyring saying that we couldn't live on an $800 a year fellowship. We needed an increase to $1,000 a year. But that was typical of the life one had to lead. And one couldn't afford a car, and if you did get married, the only way you could afford to do it is if your wife worked.
Just by comparison, what are your fellowships here at UMass?
Well, we're going up from 9,500 to 10,000 in September. So it's a factor of 10.
Yes. It's quite a bit.
And now the average graduate student is married, and they have cars, many times better cars than the professors. But the lifestyle is different. You know, I went back to Japan as a Fulbright and did this, maybe 15, 20 years ago, and it was kind of an experience because at that time life in Japan was a little bit like life was back when I was a graduate student. It was sort of like stepping back in society 20 years when people are working real hard and were hungry for education, and becoming educated was your means of improving your status of life. And in a sense, going to China a few years ago was again a repeat of the same experience, seeing people going through the stage of their development. And I think maybe the fact that the best graduate students in this country today are the Orientals is possibly a consequence of that. But back when I was a student, the Jews were essentially the people who were making it in school, and people have commented, well, today the Orientals are the Jews of our society.
When did you switch to Tobolsky?
After my first year, Henry Eyring decided to leave Princeton and go to Utah as dean of the graduate school, and he did this because of his Mormon association, and he was one of the leaders of the Mormon Church, and he took this very seriously and felt this need, and he invited me to go along with him. That I felt that Utah was more of a step than I wanted to take. Princeton was sort of a mecca of science, and at that time people like Einstein and Oppenheimer and Wigner were all there, and Utah was out in the Wild West, and I even though it meant changing a thesis, I didn't want to do that. But then I had the problem of what to do, and I thought seriously about changing schools, and I actually went up to Cornell and interviewed with DeVay, and DeVay offered me a fellowship, and I thought very seriously about doing that. But then I would have had to take qualifying exams again. I just decided that wasn't worth doing. So at that time, Bob Rundle came to the Textile Research Institute from Iowa. He was an X-ray diffraction person. I didn't know anything about X-ray diffraction. I thought, well, it was a good chance to learn something new, so I elected to work with him and changed from Eyring to Rundle. And we got in an X-ray diffractometer, and there was no X-ray diffraction at Princeton after that time. We set it up and started doing some elementary X-ray diffraction work, and I learned some crystallography. And one of the first things we did was X-ray diffraction on starch, because coming from Iowa, Bob Rundle was interested in starch chemistry. It was agriculturally oriented department. And we published a paper together on the starch iodine complex.
Interesting paper.
And then after a year, Bob Rundle decided he really liked Iowa and went back there. so I had to go through this again. So I started on my third thesis without the Nevelsky. So I managed to get out of Princeton in 3 years, having to work with three different thesis advisors. So it was, again, a good experience, but one that I think, you know, could have been discouraging. I began to think, well, is it me that makes all of these people leave Princeton?
Tell me something. You started Princeton in 46, is that correct?
Is that actually fall of 45, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then you got your PhD in 49, so...
And I actually left at 48. I got my degree was awarded after I left.
I see. Yeah. Oh, okay. All right. I'm not clear on these dates. All right. So you really only have 3 years then?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, tell me something about Tobolsky then.
Well, Tobolsky was one of this Columbia group, along with Doty and Zim, and...
You already knew him.
Yeah.
Your work
at, yeah, I had known him, and Tobolsky also had worked with Henry... Well, let's see. Yeah, he had... I guess he got his PhD with Henry Irons. He's an undergraduate at Columbia, so he was an undergraduate at the time Doty and Zim were graduate students, and then he came to Princeton and worked with Henry Eyring. So he was sort of schooled in the Eyring tradition, so changing to him was a natural. He was building up his group in polymer science. It was at the time before he got very busy, so it meant I could personally interact with him. I think one of the reasons I decided not to go to Cornell and work with Dubai was obviously a very famous person then, and I got the sense that the students at Dubai didn't work very closely with him, and I enjoyed the close association with a faculty member, and I had that with all of the people I worked with at Princeton and in the latter part of Tobolsky's career when he became busy and famous and probably wasn't as good a person to work with as he was when I did work with him.
Did the... I noticed in one of the papers there was a plastic laboratory. Now, is that...
Yeah.
Did the Textile Foundation and the Institute continue at Princeton? And what's the relationship with this plastic
laboratory? Well, that was a different endeavor. The Textile Foundation is still... The Textile Research Institute is still there. It's changed in its nature. Eyring was the first director of the Textile Institute, and then after he left, Jack Dillon became its director. And he was a very different sort of person. Eyring was mostly a scientist and a horrible businessman, so that the finances and organization of the Textile Institute were pretty chaotic during Eyring's realm, but I think the science was the best that ever went on at it. I know I spent most of my time trying to convince the textile people that before we looked at textile fibers, that one really ought to understand what I thought was the simplest polymer, polyethylene. So I managed to get the Textile Institute to support my work mostly on polyethylene during the course of my career. But Dillon was a very industrially oriented person and ran a pretty tight ship from an organizational point of view, but probably with less inspiration in science. Although he was one of the people who got the Division of Polymer Physics of the American Physical Society going, so he's a pretty reputable polymer scientist. And there's now the Dillon Award that is an award to a young polymer physicist. And then now Letty Rebenfeld is director of the Textile Institute, and I think the orientation of what's being done at it is much more industrial and applied. Now, the plastics laboratory was something that got its start with Louis Rahm, R-A-H-M, in the mechanical engineering department. And one of the people who worked with Louis Rahm then as a student was Bryce Maxwell, who developed the polymer engineering program at Princeton in the chemical engineering department, which is, again, a kind of interesting evolution, because one of my students, Garth Wilkes, who's now professor at Virginia Polytechnic, went to Princeton as a faculty member and worked in this department, and then he left Princeton to get a good position at VPI and has built up a strong polymer program there. And then he was followed by another one of my students, Jeff Koverstein, who had come to me from Wisconsin, where I worked with Stu Cooper. And then Jeff went to Princeton and spent a few years there, and then last year left Princeton and came to the University of Connecticut, which is, I think, a department on its way up in polymer science. And I and several others are who have been alumni of Princeton are concerned about the fact that the polymer effort at Princeton may be, and it's maybe dying because of these various people who have left. That is, Tobolsky never got replaced at in the chemistry department, and Maxwell retired, and Wilkes and Koverstein both left because I think both of them felt that they weren't receiving adequate support and encouragement in chemical engineering in Princeton. So a group of us, Bill McKnight from our department here, who is a Princeton alumnus, who also worked with Tobolsky, and Cheryl Matsuoka, who was a Tobolsky student. No, he isn't a Tobolsky student. He was a Maxwell student, who's now at Bell Labs. And Jack Hoffman, who was a Charlie Smythe student from Princeton, who was at NBS and now is at MMI.
Yeah.
And building up what looks like a growing polymer program there. We all went and visited with the new dean of engineering, Kobayashi, at Princeton to express our concern. And we also talked with Bill Showalter, who had been head of the chemical engineering department at Princeton. And we hope it has some impact. We don't know.
It would be a shame to see that, huh?
Yeah. It's so much. It's so easy for a department to decline, and so difficult to build one up. It's a pity to have something that had been so good disappear.
Does this plastic laboratory still exist?
Yes.
But that's in the
mechanical engineering. Well, it's been absorbed into the mechanical engineering department. It became a plastics program in mechanical engineering, and the plastics program kind of got integrated into the chemical engineering program, so it's lost some of its identity. And I think seeing what has happened there, and also seeing the decline of Brooklyn Poly as a leading place, with after Herman's Marks leaving and Charlie Overberg is leaving, I think has taught me something about what to be done here to prevent a similar thing from happening here. And I hope I'm doing things in a way to avoid this, to preserve the polymer group here as something that will not decline with my and other people's leaving, that will be a self-perpetuating organization.
What kind of steps have you taken to try to do that?
Well, have less of a cult of personality, have it less centered about a single person. I think that's very important. I mean, Brooklyn was so centered about Herman Mark, and Princeton about Eyring and then Tobolsky, that when they left, it just sort of left a gaping hole. And also not building up at the young level, having a strong base, so there weren't people prepared to fill in when other people left. And I think I'm very encouraged here, where we have an excellent group of very fine young people. I have no concern about their maintaining the integrity of the place, as long as UMass is smart enough to keep them happy by providing them with the wherewithal so they don't leave us. But we've here had three presidential young investigators in the group, and I suspect there are very few groups in any university in the country that have had three presidential young investigators among the young scientists.
How do you find the attitude, since we're on this subject, how do you find the attitude of chemistry departments toward, let's say, here but elsewhere?
Well, both here and elsewhere, I think the attitudes have been very conservative. I'm still a member of the chemistry department here, even though I got the polymer science department started here. I felt that polymer science has a place in chemistry departments, and consequently I've elected to stay in chemistry for this reason. But yet chemistry departments have not been very encouraging toward the growth of polymer science, or for that matter any other highly applied area of chemistry. When I first came to UMass, chemical engineering and biochemistry were, well, there wasn't any biochemistry, but biochemistry developed in chemistry. Chemical engineering was part of chemistry. Ernie Lindsay, who became head of the chemical engineering department, was a member of the chemistry department. And then the head of biochemistry came in, and he was a member of the chemistry department. And I got polymer science started in chemistry. But all of these were parts of chemistry, and all of them, I think, felt frustrated in their attempts to develop within chemistry, and they all split off to be eventually become separate departments, each of which is as large and as illustrious, if not more so, than the chemistry department. So I kind of feel that chemistry is really made a mistake in not encouraging its children to develop within its own walls, maybe it's been a mistake from chemistry, but healthy for some of these subfields, but chemistry departments have served to nurture many fields which have since gone out and grown up and become very good in themselves. And that has happened here as well as at many other places. And it's still a running battle. How much is polymer science going to develop within chemistry departments? And it hasn't in very many departments.
It seems as if polymer science has found homes on most campuses other than chemistry.
Mm-hmm, that's true.
And as I see it, most recently more in engineering.
Mm-hmm, that's right, yeah. Now, in a sense, this has been a sort of difficult problem here because when the polymer group got going here, I was the only polymer person in chemistry. I suspect if they understood what polymers were, they would never have hired me here in chemistry. But I over the beginning part of my career built up a polymer group here, and then we hired Bill McKnight, who was a second polymer person in chemistry. And it became evident that polymers could not develop just within chemistry. I saw the need for input from other disciplines like chemical engineering and the need for interdisciplinary activities. And I proposed that we have a polymer institute learning a lesson from Herman Mark, and this got approved by the Board of Trustees of the university through the help of John Littley, who was the president of UMass at the time. And it was a device that got readily approved because it didn't take any significant budgetary support. We got agreement from the Board of Trustees that we could get a portion of the overhead kicked back, and at that time no one worried about it because the overhead rate was only 5%. Today they're worried about it and they're changing the rules because the overhead rate is now 50%. Again, this factor of 10 coming in. But we were able to have this impetus upon our program, and then Bob Lenz got hired in chemical engineering. He was really a chemist, but chemistry department wouldn't hire an organic polymer chemist, and chemical engineering did. And then Roger Porter came in, and Roger Porter, who was the first head of the polymer science program, was hired not in any department, but as a member of the program. And it was a time during university expansion, so and UMass grew from the 3,000 or so students that were there when I was there up to 25,000 students today. So again, I'm with the factor of 10. And consequently, we were adding 1,000 students a year, essentially, during that period of time. So there was a great need for adding new faculty. So adding some people like Roger and Frank Harris and so on was not too difficult. And they got hired as members of the polymer program. And the polymer program was a very successful program. It grew very well. It eventually became a department, and now it's probably one of the largest departments in the country of its sort. And Roger, who was hired at that time, became the head of polymer science program, which became the department. He was the first department head. Bill McKnight, who I helped bring into chemistry, subsequently transferred into polymer science department and became another head of polymer science. Jimmy Chen, who was hired in chemistry just last year, changed departments and moved over to polymer science department. And the polymer science department has been trying to get me to move, and just last year I decided I wouldn't, that I would stay in chemistry and try to preserve a foot in each camp, because I just as a matter of philosophical principles, I feel that I don't want to see polymers die in chemistry.
I have some more questions I want to ask you about that, but let me return for a moment to Princeton. You said you did your postdoc with Sutherland, but I was wondering what you were looking at beyond Princeton as you were finishing up at Princeton. Were you looking at an industrial position for you?
No, I don't think at that time. Well, the economics then was better, and we had a seminar at Princeton by Gordon Sutherland, who was a professor at Cambridge University in England, and it was about the time infrared spectroscopy was just getting started, and he talked about infrared dichroism, which I had never heard of before, and I realized what some of the potentialities were in using this in polymer science, and thought it was something I'd like to learn something about. So I did some thinking about how I could get to Princeton, and I heard that there were National Research Council scholarships, and I talked to Arthur Tobolsky about this, and Arthur says, well, why not try for one? And I went to H.S. Taylor and asked him whether he would recommend me for one, and he was very discouraging. I remember saying, oh, a polymer scientist would never get one of these. There's no point trying. So I did anyway, and I remember one morning a telegram getting delivered to me saying that I had won this, and it was a complete shock and surprise. And I remember telling my mother, who had been very conservative, that I was going to be going to England, and she was pretty shocked at this. It was, again, a good thing for me to do. And I remember telling with great glee H.S. Taylor that I had gotten one, and he didn't believe it at first.
Had you had any other plans? You didn't seem to be optimistic about getting the NRC. Did you have other
plans? No, I think I had pretty much determined I wanted to do postdoctoral work, but I don't think I had applied for anything up to that stage. I had...
Do you recall what time of the year you got the notification?
Oh, let's see. I think it was in spring of the year in which I had finished. I think I finished up my thesis by the end of the summer. I went to Cambridge at the end of that year.
Okay, that would have been in 49.
Yeah, I got my master's degree that June.
Okay.
The master's degree was sort of automatically awarded at Princeton. And then I didn't get my doctor's degree until the following year, I guess.
Now let's talk a little bit about England then. You were there only a few years after the war was over.
That's right, yeah.
What was Cambridge like?
Well, life was very austere. I went to England by ship on the Queen Mary. Rod Andrews, who was also a student of Tobolsky's, also went to Europe. He worked for Verna Kuhn at Vaso. So we went over on the Queen Mary together. And then I remember we arrived in England, and Rod went on to Switzerland, and I just went to Cambridge to leave off my bags and find out where I was living and all of this. I remember stopping in at the college, at Pembroke College, and telling the porter who I was. And I was informal and told the porter I was Dick Stein, and for the rest of my term at Cambridge, I was Mr. Dick Stein. Well, at the time, housing was short at Cambridge, so I wasn't able to live at college, but I had my meals there, and I lived in Diggs, so to speak, just a private house in town where I rented a room, a beautiful room in a house that the landlady, Mrs. Hayes, was a working-class person, and she would rent out her living room and dining room, the best rooms in a house, to a Cambridge student for some income, and they would live in the rest of the house. And I think I paid all of $9 a week for this, including breakfast and getting my laundry done. And that was a good experience learning to meet some English people. But I remember at the time there wasn't any electricity in the bedroom. There was just the electricity in the downstairs part of the house. And I think Mrs. Hayes was a little bit concerned about my burning the house down, not knowing how to light gas lamps and so on. There wasn't any hot water in the house, and there was running water in the kitchen, but there wasn't any running water in the bathroom in the house. The lavatory was outdoors, and the bathtub was in the kitchen under the kitchen table, and one had to heat the water on the stove for this, and consequently it was a lot of trouble to take a bath. You had to take it after everyone went to sleep at night, and you had to heat up the water, so I can understand why people in England only took weekly baths. The weather was cold enough so they didn't smell too badly. But also, there wasn't any heat in the bedroom, and my living room got heated by a coal fireplace, and the coal ration was 100 hundredweight, which is a little over 100 pounds of coal a month, which isn't very much coal, so you couldn't stay up very late. And it was pretty cold, and consequently I would spend a lot of time at the laboratory, which did have central heating and was warmer, so that made me work a little bit harder. But a lot of food was rationed, and life was pretty austere at that time. But I just... when I initially arrived at Cambridge, just stayed for a day to get find out where I was living, leave off my luggage, and then I immediately took the Channel ship across from Harwich to the Hook of Holland to the Netherlands. Got very seasick, but I went to the Rheology Congress at the Hague, where I met Rod Andrews and first international scientific meeting I had gone to. We stayed with some students, Dutch students at the University of Delft, and that was kind of an interesting time. But, well, I visited Rod a couple of times during the year, mostly to eat, because the food in England was pretty bad, and Switzerland had good food, and I remember with the ration of milk in England was about a glass of milk a week, which most people used for their tea. Well, I didn't like tea. In fact, as I pointed out, there wasn't any hot water in England at the time, and my to do one's washing had to get a basin of water that got supplied by my landlady, and she would deliver me a cup of tea in the morning when I woke up. Well, I didn't want to drink the tea, so I got the shading with this tea. See, I don't think my landlady ever realized what I did with her tea, but I found that there was a good advantage because the tea sort of tanned my face and made it tough, and it was so cold I would be shivering a lot and would cut myself, but my face eventually got tanned from the tea and I cut myself less. But let's see, where was I? Oh yeah, the food was pretty bad, and we got a cup of milk a week, so getting over to Switzerland for some good food was a good experience. So I would few times during the year get over to visit Rod, and first time I visited I got invited to give a seminar by Werner Kuhn, so this was a good opportunity to meet that famous man, and discovered to my horror they expected me to give it in German. Which I was very bad at, and but after about a half a minute of trying to talk German without any grammar at all, he decided that it would be better for me to continue in English.
Hasn't Rod warned you about that before?
No, it was quite a shock.
What did you talk about?
Well, it was pretty much about the work I had done with Ostapovsky and studying birefringence, and it was a good thing to do because Kuhn, working with Grun, had developed the first theory of birefringence of polymers, so yeah, we did some of the early experimental application of some of his theory.
Can you tell me something about Sutherland? Did you interact with him much when you were there?
Not really closely. Sutherland was a kind of a mystery person. He was, very far up in British science and did a lot of traveling, a lot of industrial consulting, and was on a lot of government committees, and while he eventually became knighted and director of the National Physical Laboratories. But he sort of had a secret office that where he would hide out, and you'd not see him very often. Consequently, most of one's learning was from one's fellow students rather than from him. Mm-hmm. But the group at Cambridge was very excellent, and well, it was a very good year because I think a postdoctoral year where you could take courses that you wanted to without having to pass them but just enjoy them was a great fun. And
what did you take or what did you put in on it?
Well, I took a course in physical chemistry with Leonard Jones and another one with Mullen Hughes. And I took a course in X-ray diffraction with a young Bragg, and I took one with Max Perutz, and took a course in statistical mechanics with Fred Hoyle, and one in quantum mechanics with Dirac, and a course in philosophy with Bertrand Russell. So it was a wonderful year.
A stellar lineup of names, isn't it? What about the laboratory facility?
Well, again, they were pretty primitive. I seem to have the story of my life has just been going to places too early when techniques were just getting going and laboratories were just getting developed, and infrared spectroscopy and Cambridge University as a place to do science was in its very early stages. So we were doing infrared spectroscopy or infrared spectrometer was made by essentially fastening prisms to the top of a stone tabletop using beeswax. We had to polish our own rock salt, and I remember when a laboratory was in the basement of the Colloid Science Building, which got built in a department that has now disappeared, but it was set up by Radil. And that, again, infrared spectroscopy was not done in the chemistry department, but done in the colored science department, which is kind of interesting.
Yes.
But this was sort of in the basement on Old School Lane in Old Cavendish, and it was a basement lab that got flooded. And I remember one very anxious day when the laboratory was getting flooded, and we were rescuing all of the rock salt optics of our spectrometers. But also, we built one of the first double-beam X-ray spectrometers, and this was before DC amplifiers were developed, and we had to use galvanometer amplifiers, which are extremely sensitive. And well, I remember trying to take a spectrum on May 1st and getting some anomalous absorption bands that were periodic that happened to be at the frequency of a maypole dance, which students at a local school were doing. But I think that having to essentially build instruments and be in at the early stages of science was good training, because it made one not fear getting into new fields. And I think that when one gets into a new field, the instruments are crude, but you have a whole new area of science to work in, and consequently, you can do some pretty important things with instruments that might not be too good, but very often order of magnitude experiments are much more meaningful than very accurate experiments later on.
Who are some of your coworkers there?
Well, Norman Shepherd, who had become a very important person in British science. Fred Dayton is another famous British scientist who was there at the time. Alistair Valence-Jones was there, who is now in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, at the National Research Council of Canada, doing some very good atmospheric spectra. Another one of my friends was Maurice Dont, who became director of the chemistry division of the Belgian Atomic Energy Commission, and then, to my delight, became director of a chocolate company, the president of a chocolate company in Belgium. And I'm a chocoholic, so visiting him was one of the the outstanding experiences of my life. And also he became a millionaire who owned an estate in Spain, which he lent to us for a week, and our family had a delightful vacation at his estate. And let's see, Sutherland, of course, became Master of Emmanuel College at Cambridge, and there was Alexander, who was a colloid scientist who went back to Australia and did some outstanding colloid chemistry. Maybe I'll think of some others later, but a very, very good group of people.
Had you thought about what you were going to do after you returned?
No, in fact, I hadn't really done any, looking into jobs. And when I finished up a year and came back, I didn't have anything. And Arthur Tobolsky offered me a postdoc at Princeton with the idea that it would be just something that I could stay in as long as I would want to. And we had a lot of stuff to write up that we... It was a carryover from my time there, so I spent a few months at Princeton again, mostly writing and keeping my eye open for job opportunities. I went on several interviews, and both industrial and academic. And I remember one day there was a notice on the bulletin board saying that this job was available at University of Massachusetts, which I had never heard of before. So I took a train up to Northampton and looked around UMass and was impressed by all of the mountains and the nice country town, which was real quiet, just the antithesis of New York, and nothing much going on there, but it looked like an awfully nice place to work. And I think one of the reasons I might have gotten a job is that at the time UMass was quite poor and they couldn't afford to put me up at a hotel, so I stayed at Walter Ritchie's house, who was the head of the department, and I had separate his house, and I helped Maggie Bell, his wife, dry the dishes, and I think this made a good impression. They couldn't afford to take me out to dinner, so I took them out to dinner at Wiggins Tavern. No, it was Jack August in Northampton. So I got a job offer, and I came, and I had to start about 2 weeks after I accepted the job, because Dick Fessenden, who had taught physical chemistry here at UMass, became ill, and I badly needed someone to teach physical chemistry and freshman chemistry, and I think I took the job. It was mid-year. It was in January, I think, I took the job, and the course started in 2 weeks, and I started out teaching a freshman chemistry course of 80 people, never having taught a course in my life, and that was sort of like really diving into a pool of cold water. It was, I really had to pull my act together fast, but survived it. And I remember one of the things that shook me up is this course was given in Old Guestman Auditorium, which is still here, and I had been giving this freshman lecture, and halfway into my lecture, a dog wandered into the lecture hall and proceeded to get sick in front of the class, which the class loved, but it really kind of shook me up. But at that time, there was no modern physical chemistry taught here. There was no quantum mechanics or statistical mechanics. And it turned out every semester I was teaching a new course, which I had gotten started. So I gave the first quantum chemistry course and the first statistical mechanics course and the first kinetics course and the first polymer course. But each of these courses I had to get going and had to learn an awful lot. And I think at that time teaching loads were about 20 to 25 hours a week, and I was not yet married. Well, I remember I had gone to all boys school through all of my career. I mean, high school, college, postdoc, and I began to sense that something was missing in my life. And I remember taking the scientific point of view and asking Walter Ritchie about the relative population of men and women at the various colleges in the area, and I think one of the things that encouraged me to take the job was the proximity of Smith and Mount Holyoke, which were girls' schools, and I think finding a wife was one of my missions in life at the time, and I did marry Judy, who I'd been a graduate student at Smith College.
I have a number of questions I want to ask you about UMass, but let me just finish up by asking, what other positions had you interviewed, both academic and industrial? You didn't evidently weren't terribly enthusiastic about them.
Let me think. I remember Naval Research Lab and I guess I've really forgotten where I interviewed. I'm not sure, but I interviewed two or three different places. You know, my parents actually were very much for my taking an industrial job. Well, my mother was. My father had died by then, and in fact, one of the reasons why it was precarious whether I could go to college or not at Brooklyn Poly is my father had died about that time, and consequently this was a burden on family finances. But my mother was very much for my taking an industrial job, because at that time university salaries were very low compared with industrial salaries. I remember that my National Research Council fellowship in England was very generous. I think I had $4,000 a year tax-free, which was a fabulous salary at that time, and living in England was very cheap. In fact, the food ration was a food ration by money rather than amount of food. You couldn't spend more than a dollar a meal, so you could either eat a lot of bad food or a very little bit of good food, or go from restaurant to restaurant eating a dollar at each. But as a result, I couldn't spend more than half of what I was earning, so this gave me a little bit of a nest egg. And then when I came back to UMass, I think my salary was also $4,000, but I had to pay tax, so that I was really earning less than I got as a postdoc.
What was the department like when you arrived? Was there a graduate program?
Yeah, there was a graduate program. In fact, the graduate school at UMass was a rather good graduate school, but very agriculturally oriented. I think there was a study at the time that indicated that UMass was, I think, number four in the country for the number of its undergraduates who went on to get PhDs. And some of the departments at that time, that like food technology, and were very, very good. And, they were world famous, and things like cranberry juice and so on were developed by that department, and food preserving, food freezing processes and so on were developed by them. And the president of the university was Ralph Van Meter, who was a pomologist, and really the fame of the place was its ag school. And Hokkaido University in Japan got developed in the last century by William Clark, who was the president of UMass. And William Clark is buried in Amherst, and most people in Amherst don't know about him anymore, except that there's a building named after him. But he's a very famous person in Japan, and every Japanese schoolboy learns about him because he went up to Hokkaido and introduced American agricultural methods into Japan. And there's a statue of him in Sapporo with the words which he uttered when he left, "Boys be ambitious." And this is a story that Japanese schoolboys learn, like we learn about George Washington and Abraham Lincoln's childhood experiences. And whenever any Japanese come to visit Amherst, they want to go to visit his grave, and most Amherst people don't even know where it is. But, that was the kind of person we had back then, and we still have beautiful Japanese cherry blossoms right around our house because of Clark and his credit, the people who followed him, bringing these back to Amherst.
How many people were in the chemistry department?
Oh, faculty of that, seven or eight. Yeah.
And how many? Were there a lot of students, a lot of chemistry majors?
No, there were probably about six or seven graduate students in chemistry. Undergraduate education was pretty strong. There were maybe 30, class of 30 or so chemistry majors as undergraduates. In fact, the size of the undergraduate body has not changed too greatly for chemistry majors. As the university has grown, there's probably less of an emphasis on technical subjects, and the great growth has been in peripheral areas. And part of the reason why chemistry hasn't grown, of course, has been that many of the people who would have gone into chemistry are going into areas like polymer science and biochemistry and so on.
What about the facility? What kind of?
Very primitive. Outstanding piece of equipment I remember was a Beckman DU spectrophotometer. And my first laboratory was a basement room in Old Guessman that was a mill room, and I learned a mill room was a place where the agricultural school used to grind up grain to make flour. And the laboratory had no electric lights in it, and it was saturated with particles of grain, and I was trying to do work on light scattering. This was very great difficulties. The first thing I had to do was get some electric lights installed, and well, there was a piece of equipment with a Beckman DU spectrophotometer, and well, I had to figure out what could I do with a small research budget, and I knew something about light scattering, and I realized that polymers like polyethylene were turbid, and this is because they scattered light, and I figured, well, here I can put some of my ideas together this way, and you could measure light scattering by measuring the transmission of light with a Beckman spectrophotometer, but to do this, one had to have better collimation than you could get, so I made a chamber for the Beckman spectrophotometer so that you could measure scattering by transmission, and this got fabricated in the local automotive garage, Rose Garage, down the center of town, and I think it cost about $80, which I suspect exhausted the department's research budget that year. And then I got a research grant of a couple of $1,000 from the Research Corporation, and I thought, what could I do with this that would be best? So what I did is I bought a Sears Roebuck lathe so I could build other equipment, and I built my first light scattering apparatus almost to the extent of, well, to the extent of actually engraving the angular scale for measuring the scattering angle. And there was a famous correction that my students had to make for the next 10 years, because for every angle over 45 degrees, I had to add a degree, because I left a degree out between 40 and 45 degrees when I scribed the scale. I got tired of putting these degree marks on. But I chose light scattering because light was something that, you know, you could do light scattering pretty cheaply, and it turned out to be something other people didn't do. It wasn't a competitive field, and again, I think that my training and having to make do paid off, because it forced me to get into a new area of research that was innovative and I think an exciting area that turned out to be pretty good.
Was there much other research activity going on in the department?
Not really a great deal. There were, you know, three or four graduate students. Harold Smith in physical chemistry, who's now retired, was doing some work on coordination complexes, essentially using the Beckman spectrophotometer for these. And John Roberts, who's also retired, was doing some work on rare earth analytical chemistry. And George Cannon, who was an organic chemist, was doing some work on organic synthesis, mostly classical organic chemistry. But that was about it.
One of the first, well, during the course of my graduate career, I had a fellowship. Well, during the postdoc part of the career, during my graduate career, I was supported by the textile fellowship. But then during that 6 months, I was back with Arthur Tobolsky. This was slightly after the Vannevar Bush report got written, and the first government organization to support research to any extent was the Office of Naval Research. And before then, university research was pretty low-key. There wasn't much government money to do it. And I got supported by an ONR contract at Princeton. And then when I came to UMass, and after I got off the ground after my first year, I applied for ONR support. Got an ONR grant, and I suspect this was one of the first government research grants at UMass, and I got steady support on this for about 20 years at UMass, and then that petered out with other support coming, but now last couple of years I've gotten some ONR support again. But I found it was an interesting experience in bureaucracy to get started in sponsored research at UMass, because I discovered to my horror that the laws of Massachusetts were such that any income to the university went directly into the state treasury in Boston. So this meant that the funds on the ONR contract just went to the state treasury, and there wasn't any mechanism by which the money could come to me. Mm. And this was a pretty bad situation for a while, because I had to do the research but got no money to do it. And then the dean of science at that time, Charles Alexander, who was a carryover from the agricultural school days, he was a famous entomologist, came to my rescue, and he pulled some strings and got a special act passed by the state legislature to make an appropriation to me to enable me to carry out my research. At that time, we figured out how you could do business and get around this by use of trust funds, and he had this money go into a trust fund account rather than to the state treasury, and this proved to be a mechanism which is still in existence that enabled many things to be done at the university that was not possible at the time.
Was that Alexander's doing? Is that concept, or were you?
I think I helped with it, but said it was a mutual effort.
But he was certainly sympathetic to your problem.
Yeah. UMass at that time was very much of an undergraduate-oriented institution. In fact, any research that was done was gotten by pirating funds for undergraduate teaching. And when we got visited by anyone from Boston, we kept it was a very different situation today. We kept secret the fact that we were making any research progress, because if they learned out about this, they probably would prohibit us from doing it. They thought they would think we were squandering the taxpayers' money. So we had to keep it quiet that we were doing some research in our spare time. And then the real breakthrough came with one of the presidents of the university, Jean Paul Mather, who got through the state legislature something that was called at the time the Freedom Bill. It used to be that all expenditures at UMass had to get processed through Boston. And Boston was a place that was had very little interaction with UMass, and I think Bostonians viewed Amherst as something out in the country and didn't know we existed at all, almost. And the university was sort of run by Boston, but there was no appreciation for what happened here. And all of our ordering and processing of appointments and so on had to go through Boston. And it was just impossible, really, to carry on a first-rate research operation by this kind of a process. If you wanted $50 worth of something, you had to get this ordered through Boston, and the purchasing in Boston was very, very grant-ridden at the time, and that's probably why they wanted to keep it there. But it just it would take 2 months often to get an order to come back, and you just couldn't really do first-rate research. And Jean Paul Mather was able to change that and was able to get purchasing and hiring and so on done in Amherst. And I think few people today in Amherst really know who he is anymore, but I think he was the president of the university who really devoted his career to getting this through the legislature, and without that, this UMass could never have become a research university.
What was happening at the same time in other departments? You were trying to build up your research effort in chemistry. You said there wasn't much else happening. What about other departments on campus? Were there young people coming in trying to get research done too? Was that?
In some, there were some good people here and there at the university. Physics had a few shining lights. I remember I would go over to physics when I built my light scattering apparatus. It was an apparatus with a vacuum tube amplifier, and I think I still have in my files a letter from Bruno Zim, where I asked Bruno about how to put this amplifier together, and he was giving me very explicit directions about how to go down to the local radio shop and get a number 32 or something like this. But I remember in building this, I needed an oscilloscope, and there wasn't an oscilloscope in chemistry, and physics had an oscilloscope, and So I went over there to use their oscilloscope, and I remember seeing some interference in the oscilloscope, and I traced this down to the fact that the department head in physics used to shave in his office with an electric razor, and the interference was due to the this electric razor he was using. But there was not a great deal of research, but some very good teaching professors in physics, and also in engineering. George Marston, who's still living, was a dean of engineering at the time, and he really made a good effort to get a quality engineering school going, and there was a lot of comradeship at the time. I think that one of the virtues of being poor and having to make two is I think people felt very close to each other, and there was a very good spirit. Everyone knew everyone else and worked together. And it was a very enjoyable time of life. Certainly very austere, and life was hard, but it was an experience I treasured.
Did you continue to teach freshman chemistry, or did you start developing?
Well,
developed the graduate PChem curriculum.
Yeah, I taught chemistry for maybe 10 or 15 years. At the time, until freshman chemistry got so big and organized and so on that there wasn't too much room for individualism anymore, and I didn't enjoy it as much as I did. But I remember at the time I was, we had a make-do in our marriage. I think, one of the jokes in our family is I married my wife for her money because she had $500 and I didn't. But we bought our land, which was a half a block away from the university, and the land cost less than $1,000 at the time. And that's gone up by much more than a factor of 10 today. But at the time, we had to do the landscaping ourselves. And I noticed at the time they were repairing one of the streets in town, and you could buy fill cheaply. So we arranged for these trucks to dump their fill in front of our house. And I spent my weekend shoveling this fill to landscape our property. It's a house we still live in, actually. But unknown to me, this President Jean-Paul Mather had observed this in operation, and he was a great political stumper, and I discovered that in his speeches around the state trying to get autonomy of the university, he was talking about this university professor who came to us from Princeton who had to spend his time shoveling gravel.
Very good. When did the growth start within the department?
Well, for my first 8 years here, there was no salary increase, no promotion, no growth. And then public education began to take off. There was a big influx of students. The high birth rate time grew, and UMass was developing at this very great rate when we were growing 10% a year. And the department began to grow along with that.
Had you ever thought during those 8 years you ever get discouraged to think of looking elsewhere?
Yep, and I actually went on some interviews. I remember I took an interview at University of Mississippi, but this was a time when Mississippi was very conservative and there was segregation. I remember people essentially spitting at me because I went into the black men's room. And that turned me off, and I thought New England was still pretty good.
Awesome. I'm trying to think. Now, you published a number of papers on light scattering in the early years. Was this work done mostly with undergraduate students or with graduates?
Both, yeah. In fact, it was an interesting story. I mentioned Walter Ritchie is the first department head and the person who hired me. And one of my early light scattering papers was on trying to look at the starch iodine complex by light scattering. And this came from my association with Bob Rundle at Princeton. And I thought, well, here's a technique I have, and here's something I know about. I tried to put the two of these together. It turned out not to be a very good thing to try to do. It was a very difficult problem for the primitive state of the art at that time. People have since gone back and done much better with modern techniques. But to get starch. Well, we wanted to get amylose, and you couldn't go and order amylose at the time, and so I went down to a local shop, Louis, which is just expanded and become a big supermarket. But at that time, I went there and bought a bushel of potatoes, and I had this undergraduate, Carolyn Kendrow, who was working for me, and I had just married Judy shortly before that, and Carolyn was in my laboratory trying to make starch from these potatoes, and she was in my laboratory peeling the potatoes, and Walter Ritchie walked in, and he was kind of skeptical about these people doing research, and he shook his head and he said, "It's not bad enough you buy your potatoes on your research grant, but you've got your students peeling them for you." But making do with research, again, I think was something I learned about. For example, when I was in Cambridge, we had to do some work in spectroscopy on deuterated polyethylene, and deuterated polyethylene was again something that was hard to come by, and I mentioned that Sutherland was someone who had good government connections, and he had known about the fact that the British commandos had made a raid on the Norwegian heavy water plant where Germany was trying to build an atomic bomb, and they had a reactor there. And deuterium was the moderator of the reactor, and deuterated polyethylene was one of the things. And he knew there was some samples of deuterated polyethylene in a safe in the British Secret Service, and he got some of these. And we did our first spectroscopy on deuterated polyethylene on that.
Wow. Does that show up in the literature as your source?
I don't mention it in the literature.
You also started some industrial connections very early.
Yeah, I became a consultant of Monsanto at the time.
How did that develop?
Well, Monsanto had a plant, which was in Springfield, and that was a principal plastics manufacturing operation. And I gave my course in polymer science, and there were a dearth of good students, so I decided, well, I'll give this class late afternoons or evenings, because there were some people in Monsanto who wanted to learn about it. So I had more Monsanto students taking my course than UMass students, and developed an association. So I've been consulting with Monsanto for about 35 years. In fact, my last visit to Princeton, I commented that I've been with Monsanto longer than anyone that I've ever consulted with. Last year, I had dinner at the Chancellor's House that was attended by Richard Mahoney, who is now President or Chief Executive Officer of Monsanto, who's a UMass graduate. And I had completely forgotten about this, but he commented at dinner that I was in your freshman chemistry class in 1952, and you gave me a D.
We've talked about the Research Trust Fund, and we've mentioned the early papers on light scattering. You had a paper in JChemEd on inflating balloons,
uh-huh,
which is a very intriguing paper, but I was curious as to how that fit into everything else that you were doing.
Well, there's some interesting stories on that one. It turned out we used to have a day when they would, it was a nice day, they'd call field day or something like this, they ring the chimes in Old Chapel and cancel classes, and all the students would go off and drink beer. And I decided, well, I had nothing to do this day, so I'd have some fun playing around in the laboratory. And I got curious. I my kids were young at the time, and I remember trying to blow up Mickey Mouse balloons and wondering why it was always difficult to get the ears inflated. You kind of had to hold the balloon to get the air to go into the ears, and I try to figure out why this was. And said, well, this must mean that it's hard to get the inflation of a balloon started. So I rigged up an experiment where I hooked up a balloon to a just a water manometer, a U-tube that was filled with water. It might have been ethylene glycol to give a little bit more density. And just blew up the balloon and watched the pressure in the balloon and discovered to my very great surprise that the pressure would go through a maximum. It would first go up, but then when the balloon began to inflate, it would drop down again. So it was immediately obvious why it was hard to get the ears inflated, because if the body of the balloon got over the maximum before the ears did, then the body of the balloon would be a lower pressure than that necessary to get the ears inflated, and they'd never inflate. And this, well, for one thing, in this paper in Journal of Chemical Education, extended rubber elasticity theory and showed that this is predictable, and had a curve in there comparing the prediction with the experiment that worked out pretty well. And then this suggested some simple experiments that have been kind of fun to do, like hooking two balloons together with a valve and a big balloon and a little balloon, and the larger balloon would be at a lower pressure than the smaller one, and you'd open the valve, so what would happen to everyone's surprise is the small balloon would get smaller and the big one would get bigger. And I remember taking this apparatus into the local bar one night and paying for drinks for the night by having people bet on what was going to happen when I opened the valve. And, you know, 90% of the people would make their wrong guess. So it was kind of fun to do. But there was some good after results of that paper. I remember getting one letter from a person in a medical school who wanted reprints, and it turns out that the development of an aneurysm in a brain is a result of an elastic instability that is very similar to this one. And when you blow up a bubble in an artery, it continues to grow because the pressure begins to drop as it gets bigger. And also the inflation of the cells in a foam plastic obey the same principles. That's a good illustration of how sort of everyday phenomena can have applications. Now, also, I got a paper, a referee from Journal of Chemical Education, from someone who wanted to write a sequel to this paper. And I got a big chuckle out of a remark in the paper, and I had great appreciation for what this guy said. He was from a university that was even in more dire straits than the University of Massachusetts at the time. Because he had a footnote in the paper saying that he was forced to give up this research because his department could no longer afford balloons. I don't know whether he got his tongue in cheek with that, but it was kind of fun. And may I take a break?
Were you able to continue attracting students from local industry to help build the program?
Well, it's things have changed. Now very few people come from Monsanto because the rate of growth of that laboratory has dropped. In fact, it's been decreasing. Monsanto has just sold its polystyrene effort to Polysar, for example. I think most of the people of Monsanto have either gotten a polymer education somewhere, this is available now, or else they've had it, and they're not doing very much hiring. So the number of such people from industry to take courses has declined, except that I'm engaging in an experiment to do it a different way. I've just gotten a grant from an organization called Great Bay State Skills for developing a video cassette course, and I'm preparing this now on electro-optical properties of polymers. And UMass has what's called the video instruction program, where people can take courses and get university credits by video cassette courses taken locally, where the university mails out these cassettes weekly. So we're going to try giving this course on electro-optical properties of polymers, and this is supported jointly by Bay State Skills and a few companies. And we're hoping to be able to sort of have a nationwide clientele to take this course. And university now has a TV, satellite transmitting antenna, so it could be worldwide and could give it in real time. I think this is probably the way in which teaching is going to go, and I find some of the thoughts about it very exciting, because well, next week, for example, I'm going to, with one of my students and a few technicians, visit Xerox in Rochester, and we're going to do some filming of laboratory and industrial scenes at Xerox, and have some guest lecturers, and we're thinking of putting all these kinds of sequences into such a course. It means you can do things with a teaching that weren't technically possible before. Also, when you think of the possibility that you could have possibly in real time Japanese and Chinese as students in your course, the number of clientele would be extremely large.
Yes, my goodness. How do you find the attitude of your colleagues toward these new teaching techniques? Are they receptive to that?
Not as much as I would like to see. Some are, but most are conservative. Mm-hmm. In fact, you can almost see the attitude of people by those who adopt personal computers. If you look at the older members of the faculty, they don't use personal computers. They still dictate letters to secretaries. Young people don't bother with secretaries anymore. They each have their PCs in their office. They type their own letters and manuscripts. I do this myself. It's a way of, I think, keeping young. I mean, doing the things the way the young people do. I think it's kind of fun to learn something new. But you know, I think it's this difference in attitude between the, you know, young people and the old.
I suppose that difference is probably always been there too. That phenomenon is not necessarily new, but it's probably more pronounced because of technology. So different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In reading your biographical statement, I have a quote here that I wanted to follow up on. You said it became evident that to serve the needs of the developing polymer community, a larger university effort was needed. Now, I'm not clear when you realized that and at what steps you then led to the 61 formation of the Polymer Research Institute.
Well, I think it was evident that there was sort of a peak in industrial research efforts. You know, you look back into the great industrial laboratories, there were places like Bell Labs and DuPont Experimental Station and so on. You look back when Fleury and Carruthers and all these guys were at DuPont, and Langmuir was at General Electric, and two or three of our faculty are veterans of those days at General Electric. Those kind of industrial laboratories don't exist anymore, and there's a problem of where does the good fundamental research get done, and I think the universities have got to do it. But it's difficult to do it in the context of the usual university structure. So I think we need new mechanisms to encourage this. And I'm still not sure what the answer is, but part of my effort in trying to get a polymer center going here is to proceed in that direction. I think I just got a letter from one of my Japanese colleagues who's the president of a technical university in Japan, and he feels that we're probably the outstanding place for polymer education now, and coming from Japanese, I take that as a very good compliment.
Absolutely. What was it like in those early days in 61? You said you had your first job was a letterhead following Herman Marx's death. What was it like to get the real thing off the ground?
It's very slow. It took a lot of patience. Well, things went wrong and went right, but you just had to hang in. I suspect that I think one of the things one needs in life is patience and persistence to stay with it. have faith.
Did you have administrative support, or was it that
never enough?
Okay. What if, and then the department? You didn't evidently in the chemistry department. What was their attitude?
Liberal. I mean, I think that the chemistry department has always been tight on money. They still are, and I think that they've been relatively generous with me. I think that I've essentially been given the freedom to do what I want with regard to teaching. I suspect I'm a a stronger personal taskmaster than any university administrator might have been anyway, so I think that the university hasn't done badly this way. But I think that the chemistry department, I have no complaints about. I think they've been very tolerant of what I've done. I think there have been jealousies, of course. I think people have seen what I've been accomplished, what has been accomplished, and I think that's inevitable. I have a relatively thick skin at that, I guess. But, you know, they gave me the Gessman Professorship, which is the most distinguished professorship in chemistry, named after Charles Gessman, who was the first professor in chemistry at the UMass. And I think this was nice, and one of the reasons why I decided not to move into polymer science from chemistry. I feel warm toward chemistry. I think Lou Quinn, who's in the chemistry department head, is a breath of fresh air, and he's trying very hard to build up the department, and I didn't want to abandon him when he's coming in and trying to do something good. I want to be supportive of what he's trying to do.
From the time that you established your research institute, was that, did that help you bring in more research funds,
yeah,
external funds?
Yes. Yeah. It developed some coherence. It developed an image that would not have been possible as just a department effort alone.
Then how long was it before you developed your program for you, then you actually started giving degrees in?
Well, the way it worked is that when we established the Polymer Science and Engineering program, even though there was no department, we could give an interdisciplinary degree in Polymer Science and Engineering,
okay,
where there would be a thesis committee that could involve people in participating departments. And, you know, it just was successful, and it just gradually got more and more popular, and, you know, it grew to the stage where the administration finally said, this is really a department, which shouldn't be a program. And, well, when we got started, we reported to the dean of the graduate school, and then there was, when we became a department, it was felt, well, the dean of the graduate school doesn't administer any other departments other than the graduate programs of all of it, so we should report to a normal academic dean. Problem was, should we be reporting to the dean of Faculty of Arts and Science or the dean of engineering? And we were courted by both deans, and we essentially had to choose which dean we wanted to belong to, and we went the arts and science route, probably largely on the basis of the personalities of the deans at the time. I think it could have been either way.
You commented that there was a critical mm-hmm. mass of faculty, and that almost helped them maintain mm-hmm.
yep.
perpetuation.
Yep.
Do you have any...
Sure.
Can you put a number on that critical mass?
Oh, I'd say something around 4 or so. You know, it's probably why the Princeton effort isn't going. I don't have the critical mass. And one of the bits of advice we gave to Dean Kobayashi is that in order to keep someone there, you've got to get a critical mass. And we've recommended that what they really need to do is to make a major appointment and have a few minor appointments. But you bring one polymer scientist into a department with no others, he just doesn't survive. He has to interact. That's why I think that Garth Wilkes and Jeff Koberstein didn't stay at Princeton. And I think that Garth, for example, went to VBI and teamed up with Jim McGrath, and the two of them are sort of replicating what the kind of thing we've done here, maybe learning something from me the way I learned from Herman Mark.
And that, do you think that's probably a function of the fact that it's so interdisciplinary, that
yeah.
you need that interaction?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. You know, the day has passed. When I first got started in polymer science and I needed a polymer, I'd take some industrial sample and measure it. But
you can't do good research that way, that the field has gotten sufficiently sophisticated that you have to be working on a sample that is well characterized, and you need the help of others to provide this. One faculty member can't be an expert in synthesizing materials and characterizing them and doing the physics on them. And you know, the joke used to be that physical chemists did good measurements on bad things, and organic chemists had good things but did bad measurements on them. And but today, to really be successful, you got to do good measurements on good things, and that takes a joint effort.
When did, and you were active, as I understand it, in developing the computing facility
mm-hmm.
here.
Yep.
When did that take place? How did that develop?
Well, yeah, I'm not sure exactly when, but I guess one could look back in history and see that. But it was in the mid to early 60s, and it was done just out of need. One of the early papers, which I published in JCHEM Phys, was a calculation of essentially the polarizability of normal paraffin vapors. Atlee Kuhn did a theory where you could calculate the birefringence of a molecule by adding together the bond polarizability tensors. And this could be used, for example, for calculating the polarizability of a solid polymer that was oriented. And a lot of the work I did in my doctor's thesis on birefringence was based on this. Well, this theory was subsequently improved by Fleury, and actually it turns out that this theory predicted that there should be zero birefringence for polyisobutylene, and I published in my PhD thesis the fact that this was not so, that polyisobutylene had a pretty large birefringence, and Fleury never believed this because it violated his calculations. And he essentially repeated my thesis with a postdoc and confirmed the results that we got, and that the interaction over this has resulted in a very good friend. It had resulted in a very good friendship with Paul. But one of the things that we tried to do is to step backwards and realize that if we wanted to understand the birefringence of polymers, we ought to be able to understand the anisotropy of the polarizabilities of things like ethane and propane and butane and so on. And then I began to look into literature, and most of the work on that was done by people in India, essentially students of Raman. And using fairly primitive techniques where sunlight was their principal light source, and most of the data was published in a book by Bhagavantam on the scattering of light in the Raman effect. And if one wanted to quantitatively test some of these theories, the data just wasn't good enough. So I decided that really...
I just wanted to mention about the...
Okay, are you going to be in for half hour or so?
We were just
going to
go to lunch.
Okay, maybe you want to shut that off. I've got to tell my wife how much to buy. it turned out that we had to measure the anisotropy. We decided we had to measure some of these things ourselves, and a way to learn about the polarizabilities of small molecules is to measure the depolarization of scattered light of vapors of them. So started some experiments doing this, and collaborated with this with Bob Rowell, who is in the chemistry department, still is. And Bob was interested in light scattering because he did his doctor's thesis in Indiana with Gucker on looking at scattering of light from colloidal particles. So we had an NSF grant or something where we looked at the where we built an apparatus to measure the scattering, and also we did some calculations, and we looked at how the polarizability of the normal paraffins went up the homologous series. You went from methane to ethane to propane and so on, compared it with good experimental measurements. We did this before the laser, and then we did it over again when lasers got developed. And again, we were sort of doing things before you could do them very well. But it turned out that the theory and experiment were pretty bad, and it didn't work for these simple things, and consequently we weren't very surprised that there were problems with polymers. And then Bob and I tried to extend this, and it became very apparent that the stuff that I published in the theory in JChemViz was all worked out, the calculations worked out using a Marchant mechanical calculator. And I got up to C9 and I wanted to go to C10, and I hired a student to do this, and it took him a whole summer on a mechanical calculator to do the calculations, which I didn't trust, and realized that this was the limit. We had to do something different. And I went down and used a vacuum tube computer at IBM World Headquarters and realized that computing was something wonderful. When I was at Princeton, I heard von Neumann give a seminar, and he was talking about the stored program computer, and that kind of planted a seed in my mind. So Bob Rowell and I decided the university needs a computer, and we tried to figure out how we could go about doing this. There wasn't any source of money, and we found we could rent the computer for something like $30,000 a month, and if we got enough people together who wanted this, maybe we could raise $30,000. So we finally just got approval to do this, and we managed to nervously pay the bill each month, and we got an IBM 1620 punch tape computer, which we installed as the first university computing center in the library of the chemistry department. And I was chairman of the university computing committee that got established, and Bob was director of the computing center, and we essentially operated this ourselves, and it grew, and the computing science department got started, and the permanent head of the computing center got developed, and we got better and better computers. And about that time, Ed Moore became dean of the graduate school, who was very supportive, and we were going to get a real professional quality computer. And the big choice was whether we should get an IBM, a Control Data, and we finally got a Control Data 3600, but the two companies were courting us. Well, we were having a good time. They were treating us to Broadway shows and things like that, and Bob Rowell and Dean were, and I were going down visiting these various companies to try to make this decision, and we went the Control Data route. We also had to decide whether we were going to have academic and business office computing separate or together, and we decided to do it separately, which was a wise decision. And the computer science department got started, and at that time people who knew what they were doing took over, and I became a consumer rather than a producer, and history took over from there. And now we've got a very good computer group here.
In terms of your international activities, I wanted to ask you both about your early connections with the Japanese and how that originated, and then also your first trip to China.
Well, the interaction with the Japanese got started with a person that I had met when I was at Princeton, who was Herbert Lederman. Do you know who Lederman was? He was worked for National Bureau of Standards, and he did some of the very early work on mechanical relaxation of polymers, superposition of relaxation spectrum and so on. And Tobolsky knew him, and he came to visit. Lederman was one of the first Americans to ever go to Japan and interact with the Japanese polymer scientists. Japanese polymer science was done by people like Sakurada and Horio, and mostly in textile schools. The Japanese were in the silk business, and that was where the good work was being done. And Sakurada, for example, established polyvinyl alcohol as a commercial fiber in Japan, one of the first synthetic fibers to be used, actually. And
how long after the war was this?
Oh, very soon after the war. And Horio got to know Hiramichi Kawai, who just was co-winner
of the American Physical Society Prize in Polymer Physics last year. And Hiramichi Kawai was a professor in what was then the Department of Textile Chemistry and became the Department of Polymer Chemistry at Kyoto University. And he was one of the first polymer scientists to come over to the U.S. to study, and Liederman suggested that he ought to work with me. So he came and did that. And, I've forgotten the year. It was in the early 60s. He worked with me, and then he went back, and Professor Onogi came and worked with me, who was a second Japanese. And Onogi was the guy who I got a letter from yesterday. Both of these people have retired now, and then their students started coming, and one of the early students was Hashimoto, who was a co-winner of the Polymer Physics Prize last year, and Hashimoto is now a professor at Kyoto University. And now Hashimoto's students are working with me, and when I was over in Japan in January, I had dinner in Tokyo with a group of about 25 people who would work with me, but there must be 50 to 100. I've lost track.
There are at least three scientific generations.
Yeah. And with China, the thing there is that before we recognized China, just after the area of ping pong diplomacy and Nixon and all of that, there were missions to China in various fields. China was just being opened to the West, and we didn't have much idea what the state of science was in China. The first mission in chemistry was a group of 12 chemists and chemical engineers who went, representing various disciplines in chemistry, and Glenn Seaborg was the chairman of that group. And Paul Fleury was supposed to be the polymer scientist that go, but for some reason he had to drop out. And I had read in Chemical Engineering News, actually, the fact that this delegation was going to go and they were soliciting members, but, you know, really this was just a formal solicitation and the official members had all really been selected, but I had thought this was an interesting thing to do, and I had written in saying, well, I'd like to be considered if there was an opening, and nothing happened because Fleury was already chosen. Then when Fleury dropped out, I had to quickly get someone fast, and there was my letter sitting there, and I guess they checked with Paul, and Paul knew me and said I'd be a good person to go. So I got a call one morning, would you want to go to China? And this was a big shock, because going to China was something that was pretty unheard of at the time. I called home to my wife and said, should I go to China? And she didn't know. They wanted an answer that afternoon, so I went up and had a couple of martinis for lunch and was feeling good, and I called back and said, sure, I'll go. So I had to leave the next week to China.
What year was that?
Yeah, I don't remember. I think it was about 8 or 10 years ago. It was about 2 years before China was recognized. I could look it up, but I don't remember.
What? Can you tell me something about the trip?
Well, we kind of visited all kinds of places in China. Steel mills and coal mines and fiber factories, and things were very primitive. Most of these factories were built by the Japanese or the Russians during their periods of occupation. China was sort of making do, trying to keep them going. Mao was still in power then, but the Gang of Four was just about being in the process of discrediting him, and people would refer to the Gang of Four and hold up five fingers, the fifth finger being Mao, and the children were, and I remember I visited a nursery school in a commune, and the children were playing games stamping out the Gang of Four, and they had pictures of these four guys on the floor, and the children were so good going around stamping on these pictures. But people, you know, China was just recovering from the Cultural Revolution. In fact, it wasn't completely over, and people were unsure about whether they should talk or not talk. And, you know, you would hear about all kinds of sad tales. And one of my students wanted me to try to find his uncle, and somehow got word to him, and I had to, this guy called at my hotel and wanted to visit me, and you know, the student hadn't seen any of his family in China for 30 years, and it was, this guy told me the sad tale of his wife under such pressure that she committed suicide. And, you know, I was kind of surprised that people talked as frankly as they did, but the state of electronics in China was such that they couldn't really do any eavesdropping, so people didn't worry very much. But there were many, many tales of that sort that one heard, and in the group there were a few Chinese Americans. One of them was the head of chemical engineering in MIT. What's his name now? Well, I can't think of it, but he was a Chinese American, and another one was the Chinese American who just got the Nobel Prize in physical chemistry the year or so ago, from Caltech, and from pretty bad at thinking people's names will come to me, back to me. But at any rate, there was kind of a heart-rendering experience because these people were seeing family, brothers and sisters that they hadn't seen for 20 or 30 years. And it was really essentially a wonderful time to be there because it was completely unspoiled China. I mean, today it's just another tourist place.
What kind of chemistry did you find?
Well, very good and very bad. For example, there were very sophisticated projects in pharmaceutical chemistry, and one of the people in our group was Ron Breslow from Columbia. And Ron was interested in pharmaceutical chemistry and was curious as to whether these Chinese folk medicines had any basis. And he looked pretty deeply into the kinds of things that people were doing in studying these herbal medicines and so on. He thought it was pretty good stuff. Another area that I think there was some good work being done on was rare earth chemistry. China has some very abundant supplies of rare earths, and they were trying to find some applications of these, and they were investigating properties of rare earths as catalysts and so on. And one of the things that I've been thinking about recently is with some of these rare earth minerals being high temperature superconductors, whether this might affect science in China. Now, Glenn Seaborg was of course interested in what the Chinese were doing in nuclear energy, and no one knew at that time whether China had an atom bomb or not. And I think one of Glenn's secret missions was to try and to learn what he could about this. So as a result, we visited places where they're doing a lot of nuclear work, and of course the Chinese were very guarded in what they would tell us, but Glenn was trying to put two and two together, and you know, seeing where the vacuum techniques and power sources and separation techniques were such that they could possibly do this. And I think Glenn thought that it could be possible. And you know, as I was saying, the Chinese struck a note of familiarity in that they were making do with very primitive apparatus, but doing some pretty good things in selected areas by being very ingenious and working very hard. And I think they were able to put an atom bomb together on this basis, for example.
Was this work being done in an academic environment?
Well, what was academic and what wasn't was very confused at the time, because universities as such didn't operate during the Cultural Revolution. They hadn't gotten started again. So all of the universities were very practically oriented, and each university was essentially being operated as kind of a little factory. And the students were essentially doing manufacturing things, and You had to really build your own apparatus. People were trying to do gel permeation chromatography, and the presence of the head of the Institute of Chemistry in Beijing was Ringwan Chen, and one of the things he was doing is trying to make GPCs for separating polymers, and he essentially had to start from scratch and make his own columns and do his own cross-linking of polystyrene. And I've since had some Chinese students come work with me on light scattering, and one of the things that they showed me on my second visit to China, which was before they came, is the light scattering apparatus which they had built following my papers. And I subsequently learned that they were working day and night for 2 months to get this apparatus ready to show to me when I visited. They came and did some very fine work with me.
They did they have access to the scientific literature?
Not much, no. They got what they could by hook or crook. You know, they at that time they didn't respect copyrights, so they got photocopies of American journals, legally or illegally, but out of the devious roots they could, but it was very spotty.
Is your relationship pretty strong with the Chinese now in terms of this institute and
well, we went through a period when we were getting integrated by Chinese. I think we had 20 mainland Chinese in the department at once, which, you know, was a significant fraction of our graduate population at the time, something like one-fifth really concerned about this. But these were mostly people who were sent over who had their education prior to the Cultural Revolution, and it was well-founded. And China had a very large effort in trying to get these people going, because these people would then be the teachers. Now most of these people have gotten their education in the West, and now they're busy trying to educate native Chinese who didn't really get any education during the Cultural Revolution. So after that wave of people went over, then there was sort of no one to come, because then there was this missing gap in education. And now they're sort of beginning to trickle over, and they're reasonable numbers. So they're perhaps five people a year in the department from mainland China. I've, for example, got one girl in my research group, and I'm really not sure what her connections are, because she just applied like an ordinary graduate student, and I'm supporting her by a fellowship, and you know, she's being treated like no different from any other student, a very good student. But I think the relationship is more normal now.
How is their preparation now, the new ones that are coming?
Well, this girl is excellent. You know, they're awfully well selected. You know, there are a lot of Chinese and very few get here, so those that come here are usually very good.
I have a few other questions I wanted to ask you about the polymer aspect here. Polymer Center of Excellence.
Yeah.
What? Tell me something about that.
Yeah, this is a state organization. The Dukakis administration has been very high on trying to stimulate technology in the state. Massachusetts is in a good economic situation because of its emphasis on high tech. And I think that Dukakis, and particularly the person who was his Secretary of Economic Affairs and is now Lieutenant Governor and probably will someday be Governor, is Evelyn Murphy. Yeah. And the Center of Excellence was her inspiration. And she tells me that, you know, she saw the effort that we have here in polymer science, and this was one of her inspirations to get this organization going in the state, which essentially had five groups in various disciplines. Polymer science is one, and there's one in biotechnology, and one in marine science. I've forgotten what they all are. I could get their brochure if you're interested. But what these are is they're not a physical center, but they're actually an organization
which provides supportive funding from to a combination of a nonprofit group, usually a university, and an industry, each of which is supposed to make a contribution to the research project. And then the state provides matching money. And I am a member of the technology board of the Polymer Center of Excellence. The chairman of this board is Joe Wirth, who's vice president and manager of the General Electric group at Pittsfield, and I'm vice chairman of the board. And we just met last week, and we approved about $500,000 worth of funding that will probably be matched by $500,000 in matching money. So we've got about $1 million worth of funds and distributed among 8 projects. This was selected from maybe about 4 times that number. And each of the other centers is doing something similar. So it's sponsoring something like $5 million worth a year. We got a doubling of funding from last year's effort. I think it's a very innovative, good thing. The quality of the research being done is quite high in a variety of fields.
The Commonwealth of Pennsylvania operates as Ben Franklin Trust, which, from what I can see, sounds very much similar to what you're talking about. A similar kind of program. I guess lastly, there's a new polymer center coming here.
Yep.
And can you tell me something about that?
Well, the polymer center is essentially a polymer building. It was given the name to help in gathering money, and you know the psychological aspects of all of these things is something we delved on before. But right now we're space limited. We're very crowded. The chancellor, Joe Duffy, has been very supportive, and he managed to persuade a wealthy alumnus of the university this year, who is not a chemist actually, to give an endowed chair to the university of over $1 million, which is being given to polymer science. So we will be able to hire a distinguished professor in this, but we've decided not to until we get our new building, just because we don't have any space to put this guy into. And we just got a professor, Frank Harris, got one of these University Research Initiative Department of Defense grants, and we've essentially had to put up some trailers outside to have any space to do this. So we're very tight on space, so a building is really what we need. I think that the department has gotten a reputation such that research money has been coming in reasonably well, but getting money to build a building is hard. So the Polymer Center is a building, and through Dukakis and through our interaction with him, there was initially a state appropriation of $6 million toward this. We estimated at the time the building we want would cost something of the order of $20 to $25 million. So I sort of made an effort to try to publicize our need for this and look at fundraising and so on. And I think this is something that took our chancellor's fancy, and he was supportive.
Made the rounds in Washington to, is that working?
Yeah.
See what we could do. And actually Paul and I jointly went to visit Jay Keyworth a few years ago to talk. He was Reagan's science advisor, to look for funding, and it was kind of discouraging. I think all of these people realized that it was a good cause, but there just wasn't any good source of putting money together for bricks and mortar these days. The scientific structure of the federal government is such that there's no good way to fund buildings. And then we proceeded by the infamous route of pork barrel. actually, one of my friends who had been dealing with this Washington organization of lobbyists that has gotten infamous for this, put them on our tail, and they came to visit me, and I met with them. I was not very enthusiastic. I mean, they looked at the time to me like a bunch of operators, and they wanted us to join forces with another university that I won't name, but I didn't think was very distinguished, but had good political connections that they thought might be able to make a clout by having two congressmen with powerful work together. A chancellor who was a very politically oriented guy, he was an undersecretary of state in the Carter administration, and his wife is a Washington lobbyist. He was very enthusiastic about this approach, and at the time, I wanted to wash my hands of it, and I had a big fight with most of the department, because the department by this time developed enthusiasm, and I didn't, and I essentially said, well, if they want to do it, go ahead, but I'm not going to cooperate. So I said I won't, and the chancellor essentially realized, I think, that if I didn't go along, it probably wouldn't happen, and he said, well, we'll talk to the lobbyists again, and the lobbyists agreed, well, they'll do it the honest way. The only way that they would do it would be if they would have peer review. And I said, fine. So they tried, and the problem is there still wasn't anything they could do. But I remember I was having some surgery in the hospital a couple of years ago, and I got a call in the hospital from my bed from the chancellor, who was calling from a radio telephone in a car in Washington, saying he's with our congressman, and the congressman can get us $10 million, but it will be by the pork barrel route. If we proceed by the legitimate route, there's no way we can do it within the next few years, and it maybe never happen. What should I do? I won't do it by the pork barrel route unless you agree. Well, boy, that was our decision. So, you know, it was a time when I think I agreed with him. I was just completely frustrated, and I said, well, okay. So it worked. We got our $10 million, and we got $5 million more, and it looks like more is coming. I gave a talk. I was interacting with Paul Fleury during all of this time, and Paul was very much against pork barreling, and, you know, I kept him abreast of what we were doing, and I think we both thought similarly about this, and Paul didn't have any solution either, and I think he was pretty frustrated. But, you know, last year I got invited by a congressman to give a talk on polymers to the Appropriations Committee, House of Representatives, which I did, and that got us $5 million more, and I think now we've not only got assurance for $25 million, but now we're talking about putting up a building of $30 to $40 million. So it's happening, and, you know, I never felt happy about the way it happens, but again, I think the problem's with the system, and one just had to get around the system. It just, I tried my darndest, it just wasn't any other way, and in a way, I decided the end was worth the means, and, you know, it's a kind of argument we hear a lot in politics these days, and maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but at least that's what we did.
Well, this should certainly continue your position in terms of polymer science and by having this facility.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, with the building coming along and with the endowed chair, and there was just a testimonial dinner for a Congressman Sylvia Ocampo, where people paid $1,000 a plate, and several companies came to this, and they gave their money with the condition that the money go to us, and as a result, we're getting over another $100,000 from that, and that's going to finance a visiting professorship here, and this is going to actually be given to Hashimoto, probably this Japanese that I was mentioning. So, you know, I think, and then we've got this University Research Initiative, we've got the only materials research laboratory in the country that's entirely polymers, and the funding on this has increased by about 20% this year. We got one of these IBM grants. We're one of the 12 universities in the country for being supported by IBM for polymers related to computer science. So, you know, it seems to me that everything's going very well. I think that the faculty we have are first rate. I'm enthusiastic.
Well, on that note, unless there's anything else you feel you'd want to add at this point, what we've been discussing, I think I'm going to close. Is there anything else you wanted to cover that we haven't, that I haven't mentioned?
Well, just, you know, my comment is I sort of felt that this time of life I'd be sort of slowing down and enjoying just the reputation and everything, but I suspect I'm working harder than I ever have in my life and really enjoying it. My principal regret is that I'm only one person and not five, and there are only 24 hours a day, and I'm only going to live a finite number of years, and you know, I just wish I had more time and energy and everything to do all of the things that I'd like to be doing.
Well, I think it's certainly obvious that your time and energy has certainly paid off in terms of the development of the polymer work here at UMass. I'd like to thank you very much for taking mm-hmm. time out of your busy schedule to spend this morning with me. Thank you.
Yeah. One thing I might say is that actually tonight, arriving from Turkey, is Burak Erman, who is one of the last important collaborators of Paul Fleury, who developed the new theory of rubber elasticity with Paul, and he's going to come and spend 3 months working with me.
Okay. He'll be here for 3 months?
Yeah. Actually, if you want to get some reminiscences about Paul, he would be another good person to talk to is another student of mine, Do Yoon, who is a manager at IBM Research Labs at Y-O-O-N. He's manager of Research Labs at IBM. He got his PhD with me and then postdoc with Paul and maintained close association with him, and he's the person who assembled Paul's papers to put them together in a publication after Paul died. And he was just over in Japan, helped organize the IBM conference with the Japanese a few weeks ago.
Yes, we did not have a chance to talk to Paul when we started our oral histories.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, people to talk to are those two. Leo Mandelkern is another person.
I talked to Leo. Yeah. I spent several hours with him in Florida.
Guy Berry at Carnegie Mellon, perhaps. Jim Mark at Cincinnati. Yeah, I think, you know, Paul's loss is something, and I think polymer science is feels not only because of his loss of as a scientist, but as a loss as a statesman of science. I don't think people realize how much he did as
yes.
advancing the prestige of the field.
Well, I first met him in 1974 when he won the Priestley Medal,
mm-hmm.
and but I hadn't until just recently realized beyond the scientific aspects of what you're saying. I hadn't realized that.
Yeah, I remember I was at the ACS meeting in Chicago, and Paul was supposed to have delivered a talk, and I had gotten a letter from him a couple of days before that saying, let's have lunch together to talk over some of the new things in rubber elasticity theory. More important than we do that than listen to the papers. And then walked in that morning, and everyone had a glum look on their face, and I got the news, and Jim Mark and Leo were, well, no, Leo wasn't there with Jim Mark and Bruno Zlinski, I guess, but I just got the news that Paul died.
All of his scientific papers are now at the center in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
they've all been there and are being cataloged. So that was something he worked very closely with the center, and was, as I understand it, instrumental in getting it funded and getting.
Yeah, I guess his wife Emily has been very supportive.
Yes, yes, I've talked to her on several occasions.
Yeah, both. We had both Paul and Emily staying in our cabin out of the lake here in Amherst, and sort of very primitive. And some of our guests complain about the bumpy beds, and I point out to them, well, Paul Fleury's looking at that.
Well, okay, I guess I'll close then. Again, thank you very, very much for taking time out of your schedule.
If you'd like to have lunch, still.